Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. I hope you enjoy our Tech Guy show, and I know you listen every week, right? Right. Did you know that we also make Twit content available on your Amazon Echo? There's a couple of ways you can listen. We, of course, have the Flash Briefing. That's the Echo News Flash. You can get it in the U.S. and now Canada, Australia, the United Kingdom, and India. So if you listen in one of those countries and you have an Amazon Echo, go into your Echo app on your smartphone. Go pick Flash Briefing from the settings and search for Twit, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech. And you'll hear little short clips from all of our shows as part of your Flash Briefing. You can also listen to our podcast anytime just by asking your Echo or your Google Home or Siri. They all play podcasts. In the case of Echo, you just say, Echo, listen to The Tech Guy, and it'll play the most recent episode. Sometimes you have to say, listen to The Tech Guy on TuneIn. But it should work just to say, listen to The Tech Guy. Now, without further ado, you are going to listen to The Tech Guy, episode 1462, recorded and performed at first on the Premiere Networks on Sunday, February 11th, 2018. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Carbonite. From customer data to disaster recovery and backup, automatically protect everything in the cloud with Carbonite. To learn more, visit Carbonite.com. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. Time to talk tech, computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography. Yeah, Chris Marquardt, the photo guy, be joining us about an hour and a half from now. Halfway through the show. Talk about smartphones, smart watches. We've got a new smartphone coming in a few weeks. End of the month, we should see a new Samsung Galaxy S9, which will be very much like the Galaxy S8. So don't, you know, you're not going to see massive changes in smartphones for some time. Actually, Samsung says that next year, maybe 2019, they'll do a foldable screen Galaxy. Maybe the next Note, the Note 9 or Note 10, will have a... So I think that's kind of interesting. It'll have a front... According to... Gosh, have we seen leaks? Have we seen... I think Samsung's actually been talking publicly about this. It would have a front just like a regular phone, but I guess it'd be slightly thicker because you'd then be able to open it up. And inside, you'd effectively have something like a 6 or 7 inch tablet by opening up the wings. So you'd have two screens on the phone. Can't imagine what that lineup costing. Samsung's already said they're going to raise the price in the S9. I think it's going to be $850 to start. So they get more expensive. I don't know. Do they get better? I guess so. I think the iPhone X is a step in a new and interesting direction. I think so. Apple's in an interesting conundrum. This is the most challenging time for any company, particularly tech companies, which are innovation driven. You know, if you're Nabisco and you're making cookies, coming up with the next cookie is not that hard. Let's fill Oreos with Fruit Loops flavored filling. Actually, it was Fruity Pebbles, wasn't it? It wasn't good. And I don't think they're still selling it. But that was innovation, if you're making cookies. Making an innovative new technology device is not easy. You've got a lot of challenges. You've got, of course, to invent the technology. Actually, even before that, you have to figure out, what do people need? What do they want? It's kind of... we all live like princes now. At least those of us who are not... poor, but if you have a little bit of money, if you're middle class or higher, you live like a king of royalty of 1,000 years ago or 500 years ago. So what do you do to what need could you possibly you've got at this point? They're I think literally making up things. Well, you need to wear something on your face that takes pictures of where you're going and shows you what you're looking at. And you need something in your ears that'll tell you your heart rate. Yeah, they're literally at this point, creating needs. I guess you don't need really a Fruity Pebbles flavored Oreo either, but maybe the whole world has come to the point where we're pretty well served, you know. We're doing okay. So Apple's got that problem. Something new. An emoji. Yeah, the world needs animated, my face animated as a monkey. That's what it needs. Or a robot or an alien. That's what. So that's the first challenge. Second challenge is now you got to figure out how to, got to invent the technologies that make it happen. Face recognition and depth sensing cameras and infrared and all this. And you got to make that, invent that. And that's not even the end of the line, because then you have to figure out how to produce it. And if you can't produce it efficiently and economically, and when it comes to Apple, in the tens of millions, there's no point. There's lots of things one could come up with that you can't really produce economically. So Apple has this challenge. They have another challenge, though, that the current iPhone is 70% of their income. 70% of the money Apple makes comes from the iPhone. So and Apple's pretty good about this. It's risky to do something, the next thing. What if you invent something and it kills the iPhone, but it doesn't generate the same amount of revenue? You say, well, that couldn't possibly. How could that happen? Well, it happened to Kodak. You ever hear of Kodak? Kodak had a very good little business, film processing, film creation, processing, developing. Nice little business. and then along came digital photography. Now Kodak, the folks at Kodak weren't dumb. They realized, well, this is going to be, we're going to have a problem here. They went in. In fact, they made one of the very first digital cameras. They went all in on digital. They bought a company called Ophoto that allowed you to store and print your photos online on the internet. They did it all right. They said, yeah, we're moving to the next thing. There was one little problem. Yeah, sure, they innovated, but there wasn't as much revenue in digital photography as there was in processing and printing pictures. Not even close. And the company went belly up. They're kind of back in a new incarnation. I don't know if it doesn't have a lot to do with anything photography, but that's a challenge. There are many cases in case studies in business where companies innovated themselves out of business. So Apple's got this really interesting challenge. It's not just Apple. I mean, Apple's one example, but Samsung, all these companies. That's four or five things you've got to get just right to come out with the next big thing. Apple's looking. Oh, they're always looking for the next big thing. For a while they thought it might be self-driving cars. They were wrong on that. Well, I'm not sure they were wrong on that. They just were wrong that was the next thing for them, right? They released this week maybe something interesting and new. It's the first time Apple's. Well, it's not actually the first time Apple's made a speaker. They made a speaker that was a terrible flop called the iPod Hi-Fi. Do you remember that? This was in the Steve Jobs era. You docked your iPhone or iPod into it. I guess there wasn't. It was before iPhones. You dock your iPod into it. It had a 30-pin connector, and it would play music. And Steve Jobs, being the great marketer that he is, he was a music fan and loved stereo, had very fancy stereo equipment. He said... I was a little skeptical even at the time. I'm getting rid of all my high-end hi-fi equipment for this amazing speaker. Apparently didn't convince anybody because the speaker was a flop and discontinued soon after. So this is Apple's second speaker. It's called the HomePod. Now Apple's got a new idea. What, it didn't invent it, but what if we made something kind of like the Amazon Echo, right, or the Google Home? It has a voice assistant in it. In this case, Apple's voice assistant, Siri. What if we made a Siri-enabled speaker? But not just any speaker, says Apple. We're going to bring in the best acousticians and speaker designers. We're going to do the science, do the computing research, create the chips. They actually put a chip in this new HomePod that is the same as in the iPhone 6. That's a smart speaker. And we're going to put some interesting things in it. We're going to put array microphones that allow it to hear you from anywhere in the room. It's kind of like the Amazon Echo. And we're going to beat the Echo with this, because we're going to make, this isn't about talking to something. This is about the best speaker we can make. Unfortunately, it's the size of a toilet paper roll. It has a little subwoofer in the top firing up, and then it has seven tweeters around the bottom going in all directions. But there's something Apple, even the great Apple can't do, which is override physics. And unfortunately, sound production is somewhat, you can put a lot of computation into it, but ultimately the physics will out. In a smaller enclosure like that, it's just you can't produce deep, rich sound. So I had the HomePod now for a few days. And, there are a couple of problems with it. First of all, if Apple's selling this as the greatest speaker ever made, it is not. It's pretty good. It is, frankly, not better than a similarly sized Sonos speaker, not much. And it's definitely not as good as a nice stereo system. Won't replace your stereo system. So it's okay. It's expensive, $350. Siri is very limited. And it will only work with Apple Music. And you have to have an iPhone or an iPad. So it seems to me the rebirth of the Apple iPod Hi-Fi. I feel like we've been here before. Hard to recommend. It sounds good. I'm not saying it doesn't sound good. It sounds good for what it is, which is a toilet paper-sized, roll-sized speaker. Not that big. Can't be that rich in the bass. If you really like music, get a stereo. It's still the best way. Get good speakers. Get a stereo system or a surround sound system. It's still the best way. You got to have big speakers. You got to have a subwoofer if you really want to hear. And I realize what it comes down to is hearing all the music. If you're going to hear part of the music, an AM, little tinny AM transistor radio, you hear a little part of the music, not all the music. You hear something. A little bit bigger speaker, you hear more of the music, but not all of the music. To hear all of the music takes some investment, time, energy, research, and money. And you can't get around that with a toilet paper roll-sized speaker. You can't. We'll take a break. Hey, we're going to take your calls. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. If you've got a question, a comment, a suggestion, you want to yell at me and say, this thing is the best thing I ever heard in my whole life. A lot of reviewers said that. 888-827-5536. 8888-ASK-LEO. The phones are open. Kim Schaffer's here answering the phones. Let's get to your calls next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I love Twisted Mister.
How's your cup date going?
Cup date is, I think, done. Let's see. Yes, my firmware is up to date on my coffee cup. So it is now battery level 100%, temperature level. It's empty. Let's turn it up a little bit. We're going to turn it to 135 degrees. Here you go. Make some coffee in this mug.
So
I don't know. It's on. It's heating up.
Oh, there's the light.
It's heating up.
You microwave a little bit of cream first.
Don't microwave that. Exactly. So you don't have to microwave the cream because it'll be heated up by the fine mug. Yeah. I love the comment from, was it Marsworm? Twisted Mister, levels of music reproduction systems. For $100, you can hear the beat. For $1,000, you can clearly hear the drums. For $10,000, you can hear the drummer's intestinal disturbances. For $100,000, you could tell what he ate that caused it. I'm not trying to get invited to Apple events, I promise. That's not my goal in life. Wouldn't mind, but... That's not my driving force, as it seems to be for some, though I might say. It's interesting how many of the tech press raved. But, even I think raved in principle over the HomePod. But only in principle. And it sounds good. It's not that it doesn't sound good. It's a very nice speaker, but you always have to add for its size. There's just no way around the physics of it. And it is interesting. I tell you, if you have an environment, let's say you're in the kitchen, the kitchen, you're moving around, there's noise, there's stuff going on. The best way to listen to music is to sit down at the sweet spot in a stereo system and listen to it. But often you want music in the background. And for that, I think the HomePod is good for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's adequate reproduction. Not great. It's adequate. And it's non-directional. So as you move around, it will sound good no matter where you are. You know, speakers tend to fire front and sound better in front. And I don't think that that's, you know, the HomePod's good in that respect. So it's a good kitchen speaker. But, you know, I feel like people are selling it as like, oh, you get two of these, you got a stereo. That's not true. Not true. Get a, spend some, if you want, if you like music, get a nice stereo. Sorry, that's, you know, that's what you have to do. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. Kim Schaffer's here. She is answering your call.
With my pumped up kicks.
You're wearing pumped up kicks. Oh, because of the song. I get it. Yeah. Trying to figure out what your shoes were. So just as an example of technology that is perhaps inventing a need that doesn't exist, I have this new coffee mug. It's a USB coffee mug. It charges and it keeps your coffee warm. It's got a little heater in it. I was going to try it today, and I was going to have some coffee. But then, you know, it pairs to your phone, and your phone controls the temperature. And then it said, "Well, your coffee mug needs a firmware update." So I had to wait for my coffee. Okay,
I just have one of these.
Yeah,
it works.
It works. A regular ceramic.
Like my coffee's kind of cold
but
already.
It gets cold, doesn't it?
I just made it when you were walking in the door. Yeah, it's already cold. So
I'll give you I'll give you feedback on that. Problem, truthfully, I drink my coffee so fast. It's not a cold. It's not a problem. Yeah. So you've been answering the phone.
I have.
Coffee powered.
Yes.
You're a coffee achiever.
I have half cup down.
8880. See, that's the problem. See, you have to put your coffee down to answer the phone.
I do.
Yeah. Oh, there's my
and there's your phone.
My doorbell ringing.
Oh, somebody's
at home.
Somebody's at the door.
I
don't want to be that
one. No,
I really don't.
I'm sorry that I am. Sometimes I am. So, wow, my mug is 172 degrees right now.
I don't think I could drink that for another 30 minutes.
Well, I think that's because the coffee's being made.
Oh.
It's going to maintain it. See, I can control the temperature at 135. I control it.
What is the perfect coffee?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Every time I make coffee, I have to wait about 10 minutes or so.
Because it's too hot.
It's too hot, yeah.
I did a Kickstarter of the Temperfect mug that has some material in it that when you put the hot coffee in it, it melts this waxy material. It's in the insulation of the mug.
Yeah.
And then so it holds that heat and then it kind of redistributes it back into the coffee over time. And in theory, that passive system keeps it warm. But this is an active system. This actually is a mug with a heater in it. Crazy.
I never thought I'd see the day.
Crazy. All right, so who should I talk to first?
We're going to go long distance. Matthew in Austria is having problems with his Dell laptop taking
Osterreich.
A really long time to boot.
Oh, no. Thank you, Kim. Hello, Matthew. Good to talk to you.
Hello, Leo. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks for calling. You listen in Austria, huh?
I do. It's via live stream and on your podcast.
Well, welcome. I love Austria. I was in Vienna about a year ago, and I just had a blast. So what can I...
How did you like it?
I love it, and I especially love the soccer tort, and very good coffee there. You don't need a heated mug in Austria because you're just going to drink it right away.
that's true.
Nobody leaves the coffee sitting in Austria. You just drink. It's too good. So what can I do for you? Dell is slowing down, huh?
Yeah, unfortunately. I mean, I bought my mother-in-law a Dell Inspiron 17R 5721. I put Windows 10 on it. So I bought Windows 10, installed it, ran flawlessly, actually, up until 1 or 2 months ago. It booted up within 10 seconds or 20 seconds, and right now my mother-in-law has to wait for like 5 minutes.
5 minutes?
Yeah, there's a black screen and just the mouse pointer there. And I was actually checking the forums on Dell. I was checking a Microsoft forum. I was typing in, I was asking Google, and there is actually nothing on the internet because I have the BIOS updated. I have the... even though it's a 250-gigabyte hard drive, it's just like 20% full or stuff. So.
Yeah.
I don't know what it could be.
I know what it could be. And I'm surprised the internet isn't full of this because it happens all the time. And it's not just Dell. It's every computer. She has a traditional spinning hard drive, the old school hard drive. And there's some what happens with all hard drives, new or old, is that sometimes sectors are hard to read. The operating system doesn't give up, though. It gives up after a while, but it will try a few times. So what's my suspicion is, and this is the most common failure of computers and spinning drives. One of the reasons I like SSDs, it depends how much you like your mother-in-law. You might want to put an SSD in there. But what's happening, I think, is the hard drive. Some of the sectors are hard to read, and they're unfortunately the sectors it needs to start the system up. So that's why it's taking so long, is it's reading. My suspicion is it's reading. Didn't get it. Try again. And if it tries three or four times on every sector, that could take 5 minutes. Now, there could be other things going on. It's my suspicion it's that because of you say it's on the black screen. If it were farther down the road, it is, of course, possible that there's software on there that's hanging it up. So the other thing to look at is when you first start up the computer, you know you can get into a boot menu, a text menu.
Yeah.
Hold the shift key while it's booting. And one of them is a boot with a boot log. And you can actually see the booting process as it loads. It makes a text file in the root directory, bootlog.txt, and you can read it. It's just a plain text file. So what you could do, if you want a little more diagnostic information before you get a new hard drive, is turn that on, boot it up, and stop the boot process when you're stuck in that black space. And then, reboot, shut it down and reboot it, and then read the boot log. And it'll tell you what the last thing it loaded was. And it could be that there is something there that is hard to load, that is a problem, or it could be that that file's the one that's damaged. You would really improve this Inspiron considerably by going out and buying a solid-state drive. And it depends on how much you want your wife to love you and your mother-in-law. I think for a mother-in-law, $100 for a solid-state drive to speed up boot times to seconds would be worth it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. It's really great to talk to you. Thank you for calling from Austria. Yeah, failed hard drives or failing hard drives would commonly cause that. But you could also have malware doing. I mean, there's lots of things that could cause it. But it's my suspicion it's the hard drive. It's just trying to read it.
Okay, terrific. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Hey, appreciate it. Keep listening, and get an SSD.
I will.
Yeah. Tell mom you really love her. Your wife will be very happy, Matthew. All right. And next time I'm in Vienna, I'll wave. I hope to be there soon again. I loved it. The museums. Oh, my God. We went to, I think it was in Vienna, we saw the golden lady.
Oh, the Kiss.
The Kiss. I love Klimt's Kiss. What's the name of that museum? It's the most beautiful museum I've ever been in. It's an old... Yeah, it's an old palace, right?
You mean the one with the golden roof the state for us?
Yeah, such a gorgeous museum. The building alone is a work of art. And then, of course, you wander around, and we didn't know that the Kiss was there. It's one of my wife's favorite paintings, and we came around the corner, and we practically fainted. That's the Kiss. And it is so beautiful in person because that gold leaf that he put on there really shines. And of course, a great history of that. If you see the movie with Helen Mirren.
Oh, absolutely!
Yeah, so nice to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Have a wonderful day. Take care.
Same to you. Bye-bye.
So there's a good conversation going on about coffee temperatures. And James, you're right. Brewing the temperature of the water as you brew. I typically like 200 degrees. It could be anywhere from, less to boiling, but I usually 200 for brewing. But that doesn't mean that's the temperature it'll be when it gets to the cup, right? Or the temperature that McDonald's recommends for it to be when it's delivered to the customer. It's going to be less than that. This is quite good. Thank you, John. So there's a difference in brewing temperature, the temperature of the water as it goes through the beans, and the temperature that you want to maintain it in the cup. Drift away. Always brew between 195 and 205, but what is the drinking temperature? 120 to 140, and that's good because I set it for 135. I think any warmer than that, it starts to burn. Let's see what mine is right now. Select the mug you want to control. Yeah, it's 138. Should make it a little less, maybe. It's 135 actually is a good temperature. I'm going to keep it there. It's 138 because it was, you know, just brewed. It's nice. And you don't have to keep it on the charger, I guess. So I just disagree. We did a test yesterday where we compared it, for instance, to the Echo, the Sonos One. Similar size.
I'm not quite sure how to help you with that.
Yeah, of course you're not. And it's better. Not much better. If you put it next to a stereo, I think you'll feel a little less sanguine about how good it sounds. You're missing a lot of the low end. It sounds great on voice, by the way. It sounds wonderful on voice because it's the voice mid-range, right? Windows slow boot. Ah, look at this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888, ask Leo. Hey, I really want to thank the chat room for coming up with some interesting information about a slow boot. Uncle Bic in our chat room found an article, and we're going to pass, Matthew, I'm going to put this in the show notes at techguylabs.com, at expertreviews.co.uk, particularly about this Dell Inspiron 17. So there are a few things you might want to look at that I did not mention. For instance, ironically, in Windows 10, there's a fast start option. They mentioned that on an Acer Aspire V5, disabling Windows 10 fast startup, sped up startup. Disabling it. So there's one thing to do, is turn off fast startup to speed up your startup. Now, that's for a particular device. They did mention, interestingly, that graphic drivers on the Inspiron 17 could be problematic. Let me quote, because it describes your problem exactly. Some have theorized the black screen before boot, which is what you were seeing, is a graphics driver problem because that Inspiron has a dedicated NVIDIA or AMD graphics card. It has what we call a GPU, a graphics processing unit. Most computers, but most laptops especially, use the graphics that the Intel processor and the system on a chip provides. They call it motherboard graphics or Intel HD graphics or that kind of thing. But if you put a dedicated card in a laptop, I remember my Surface Book had this problem as well, it can make the switch difficult or it can confuse the boot up. So Expert Reviews suggests disabling the AMD or NVIDIA graphics driver on your system, depending on which you have, and restart and see if that speeds things up. You can do that in the device manager. And if it speeds things up, then you've narrowed it down. And the problem with that is, of course, you really want you bought that thing because it had dedicated custom graphics. So you want to make sure, if that is the problem, they say get the latest drivers. Maybe that'll fix it. From AMD or NVIDIA instead of maybe from Dell. I don't know. You know, this is video driver issues are always, you know, troubling on a PC. And there are generally at least three different drivers you could get, at least with NVIDIA. NVIDIA will have what they call a reference driver on their site. The card manufacturer, NVIDIA doesn't make the cards, other companies do. The card manufacturer will have their driver. And often Windows has its own driver. Microsoft has a driver. And sometimes there are two Microsoft drivers, the WQHL driver, or that's the Windows Quality Hardware Lab driver, and a more generic driver. And you might have to try all of them to find the best one. They also say the AMD graphics card has a power saver option. Now, this one's complicated. It requires a registry edit, and I don't want you to have to do that. They say this is a Windows, could be a particularly a Windows 10 issue, and sometimes merely a clean install of Windows 10 will work. I think you want to have the fastest boot up. I still would stand by put an SSD in, and that, by the way, will give you a clean install of Windows 10. Sometimes an upgrade from Windows 7 or 8 to Windows 10 or any operating system to a newer version can cause problems as well. You have cruft left over from the old version that kind of sticks around and confuses the new version. But don't get your mother-in-law angry by accidentally deleting her data. Make sure you back that all up. So before you do this. So there's some good, we'll put this in the show notes. And that brings me to the most important point in this conversation, which is we have a website, techguylabs.com, and we put everything I talk about there. And I know what you're thinking. Oh, yeah, sure, Leo, you make a little extra money, you charge money. No, it's free. No sign up, no subscription, nothing. It's all there because I want you to have that information. Techguylabs.com. So anything you hear on the show, there will be links there. There will be information. There's even the audio and video. Yes, video from the show. It's a radio show, I know, but for some reason we do video. Of the show will be on the website after the fact. TechGuyLabs.com. And thanks to James DeRuvo. He writes all that stuff down. On we go. Onward and upward. Michael, Arkansas. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Michael.
Hello. Thank you for taking my question.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah. So I kind of do the tech stuff for my friends and family, and the issue that I'm having is this is a story of three unlocked cell phones. So I just ordered myself a Motorola phone from Motorola.com, and I put it on Red Pocket Mobile. Works great. Works fine. So I told my uncle and his wife, because I got them to get unlocked phones. His wife got this Galaxy S8, and he just got a Motorola phone just like I did, unlocked from the carrier, from the manufacturer. But they've moved their phones around to a couple carriers. First, I think we had it on Verizon Wireless. Then we moved them over to Total Wireless because they saved $10 a month. So now that I've just found out this Red Pocket Mobile is way cheaper, they could save even more money. We went to do that. Well, the problem is first they tried to port the number, and they said the Total Wireless wouldn't let them port the number.
Whoa, that's illegal.
The minutes ran out for two or three days before the SIM card got here. So they said, we do not port numbers for inactive.
They found a loophole.
Right.
Wow.
So what we did, we just said, forget it. So we called back Red Pocket Mobile and told them, just assign us a new number, no problem. They said, well, it could take 24 hours for that cancellation of the port forwarder to go through. So we called. So this is a three-day venture.
Oh, man.
So this is on
mess.
On Galaxy S8.
Yeah.
Right. So trying to speed it up here. So the point being is they tried to put a new number, but then they get an error in their system that says device active on another line.
Oh, yeah.
So they tell me that it's actually Total Wireless that's causing the problem, that it's not them. And I'm like, it doesn't sound right. This is an unlocked phone. These people can't hold my phone hostage.
And you pulled the SIM out, right? There's no SIM in it, right?
Correct. Right,
so
right.
So there's no way associated with the other the former company because it's unlocked. Right. I should explain what that term means. It means there's a different kinds of locking, but this is called carrier locking, where the carrier, when you get the phone from them, says you can only run it on our network. If you buy a unlocked phone, you can run it. You should be able to run it on any network that is compatible with the phone.
Right.
That means just has the right radio frequencies and all that. So. Yeah, I don't know how Total Wireless could do what they say they're doing. I think it's their computer system that's confused. Go ahead. What else?
Not only that. So my uncle's phone card came the next day. So after 3 days of dealing with the Samsung Galaxy S8, trying to get it activated on Red Pocket Mobile, his card came when he's also on True Wireless, and it gives the same error, but this time we didn't do the number port, even though he had minutes on.
Oh, this is interesting.
We're going to deal with that.
Yeah.
Right.
So here's probably what's going on. There are settings in that phone, for the APN settings for data and so forth. You really need to clear that phone out. Total Wireless probably, in the process of making it compatible on their network, changed the APN settings and other settings. And they may be blocking still. So have you done a factory data reset on those phones?
You know, I didn't try that.
Yeah, I think that will wipe out anything that Total Wireless did to those phones. If you don't have a Total Wireless SIM and you do a data complete carrier, you know, factory reset on it, there shouldn't be anything left from Total Wireless unless they somehow modified the firmware. That seems unlikely.
What I did though is I took my working SIM from my Motorola phone and popped it in there.
Yeah.
And as soon as it sees the new SIM, as soon as it sees the new SIM, it reboots and reprovisions the phone. So I'm
perfect.
I'm guessing, but the problem is it says device is not active on network or something.
That's the APN settings. That's a separate thing from the provisioning. So there's radio provisioning. You know, sometimes you'll see your new software from your carrier. And then there's also the APN settings. You need to fix those too. Hold on a sec. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So you can't get on the data, but the phone works on your phone.
No, I can't even make phone calls with them. I can't even get a phone number to. I can't get the card to activate on the Red Pocket mobile SIM will not activate.
Sounds like Red Pocket, I wouldn't be surprised, uses a data network for the phone calls even. So. Wipe the phones. Can you wipe the phones? I know they won't be thrilled about it.
Yeah, I'm sure. Whatever I need to do to get it.
Yeah, I think that's the first thing I would try. And, you know, you could go into, if you go into the cellular settings on the phone, you'll see, you know, you can try to clear those first to see if that works. Go in there and clear the APN settings, things like that. I'm not familiar with Red Pocket. I'm wondering if the way, and I'm looking at their website right now, one of the ways that they make it so affordable is that they just use data. That would be interesting.
I don't believe it's that way, but it's possible. Yeah. I mean,
free unlimited international. This looks good. I like this. This is a very affordable.
It's awesome, especially for low base. If you don't use a lot of data, it's great.
Whose network do they ride on? Do you know?
Well, they're on all four networks, but I'm using the Verizon. I'm using the CDMA-V.
Okay.
CDMA Verizon,
so you can choose?
Using them. Sure, yeah. You can all choose from all four carriers. It's got GSM, AT&T, GSM, Sprint, CDMA's
That's
Sprint.
Interesting.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
So, yeah, no, I'm looking at it right now. So,
right.
So it looks like they support... all the different networks. They have MVNO deals with all four
majors.
Networks. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Right.
Red Pocket. I'll have to find out more about them. This is new to me. So thank you for that tip.
Yeah, no problem.
But this, this is kind of an interesting company. Wipe the phone completely. Do a factory reset.
Yeah, I'll try that.
I bet you that they're doing some interesting things here. And you might make sure it's compatible. The network you're choosing a CDMA network for those. Were they Verizon?
Yeah. No, they're unlocked devices. I mean, they're
unlocked is not related to capabilities. Remember?
Yeah, I understand. But like for instance, my Moto G5S Plus is unlocked for all major U.S. carriers. For instance, this phone will do.
Yeah, it has to have the radios for. Has to have the right radios for all the right frequencies. So different carriers use different data frequencies and so forth. But that could be the issue, but probably not.
Yeah, it's because the Total Wireless is actually using a CDMA Verizon also. So they're going from CDMA Verizon to CDMA Verizon, just using a different carrier.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds like it should work, but make sure. I think probably there's carrier settings that Total Wireless put in there that you need to wipe out. So you can go through.
I'm
the
one that set it up, though. I mean,
yeah, but they do. They can do that automatically, right? They can push out.
I see. Right.
So I suspect they push something out, and you need to wipe it out. And I would think a factory reset would wipe everything out.
What's interesting is I've called them over like three or four times and said, "Look,
they don't want you to switch."
They're not helping me.
Of course not.
They're not telling. Yeah.
Yeah, we could thank our fine FCC for not regulating the cellular carriers. You know, they let these guys get away with murder.
Yeah.
So
the whole point of buying an unlocked phone.
Right. So I think try effect, you know, go in the cellular settings, see if you can see anything. Maybe, and there might even on that phone, I don't know, there might be a white, you know, clear cellular settings. But if not, just do a factory reset. Okay?
Well, thank you, Leo.
Hey, nice to talk to you. Great to have you listening.
Yeah, thank you.
Take care, Michael. Cellular companies really make you feel like you're on the crazy train, don't they? They get away with murder. It's funny because even though AT&T and Verizon are no longer Ma Bell, they no longer have a monopoly, they sure act like it. They sure act like it. It's like, oh, you can't do that. What kind of business charges you a fee to stop using them? What if, you know, and I understand that initially this was because they subsidized the phones, right? Because you only pay $200 for the phone. And in effect, your membership, your continued business with them, the contract that you're under, let them charge you over a period of time for the phones, usually 2 years in the U.S. In Canada, it's 3 years. But after those 2 years are up, or if you buy the phone outright, which more and more people are doing, if you buy an unlocked phone, you've paid for that phone. They're not subsidizing it. They should have no rights to you. You shouldn't have an early termination fee. That's ridiculous. 8888-ASK-LEO. Melanie is on the line from Irvine, California. Hi, Melanie.
Hi, Leo.
What can I do for you today?
Oh, I have a major problem. I can't get into my Google account, and I read what you had printed previously. I did all of that.
Uh-oh.
And what happens is, you know, it asked me for the email. I give it to them, and someone changed the password.
So you were hacked.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they send a code to my cell.
Yeah.
I put that code in. They send a code to my alternate
good.
Email.
I'm glad you had all of that set up. That's really good. That is my advice always for Google accounts. If you haven't done that, folks, if you're listening, make sure you have a backup phone number and a backup email address that's not related to your Google account. Now, the problem is that did the bad guys, when they hacked your account, I mean, if they want to control your account, they may change that information. Did they change that information? Did you get that text message or that email?
Yeah, after I put that in, this thing pops up and says, you know, sorry, too many attempts, and then locks me out. And I even went to Google in Irvine, and you can't get in the building.
No, you can't go knock on their door.
No, they have your phone, and you say, I want to speak to somebody.
Now, if you were paying, that's funny. It's like going to Oz, right? Knocking on the door of the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah,
they're not going to let you in. If you were, there is a phone number you can call, and there's a support number. But remember, this is all free for you. If you were paying for Google services, you would have a better support. But as a free service, the fact that they give you support is nice, but not, you know, I mean, you can't expect them to spend a lot of money on support. I've never seen this too many attempts. Does it say wait a day and try again?
Yeah, it says wait a few hours, and then, like, I'll wait overnight. And in the morning, it goes too many failed attempts. So I'm wondering if the person that's trying to hack in is doing the same thing.
And you're doing this at what website are you doing this on?
I've tried it on just the Google email.
So you go to gmail.com and you try to log in there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Make sure you're doing it on the Google's official Google site.
Too many
attempts, but you're only trying once.
Yep.
Why did you think that it was hacked?
Well, what happened, I stopped getting my email all of a sudden. So I went into my account, and I put my password in again, and they said that wasn't my password.
Okay. So, yeah, they changed your password, but weird that they didn't try to – oh, I know why they didn't try to change the phone number and email, because before Google does that, they'll send you a text or an email saying, you know, your password, your thing has been changed. They didn't want to let you know. Although by changing your password, they are letting you know, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And there are, if you go to Google, there are, you know, recovery processes, but you've done the right thing. This is the odd thing. You have a backup email address. How can we get around this too many attempts?
And then they don't ask me any questions. They say, you know, you haven't answered your questions, and they haven't asked me any.
Oh, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Google does not do security questions. So this is interesting that you're seeing that. Make sure you're entering in by hand gmail.com, that you're actually you're sure you're going to the password. They don't ask for questions. They don't ask. They don't have because that's a terrible security practice. These secret questions. I'm a little worried now about where you're actually trying to log in from.
Yeah, I've tried in from my regular computer, from my laptop, from my iPhone. And
same thing every time.
Mm-hmm. And
boy, this is
again, it'll come up with saying you didn't answer the questions right. And they ask me, like, when did you start the account?
Oh, those questions. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's the password recovery process if you don't have a backup phone number or a backup email. Mm-hmm. What they're trying to do is keep somebody from hacking your account. And they don't know that it's you for sure. So, yeah, so they ask you, yeah, when did you start? I know what questions. They're not talking about secret questions. If you can't recover your password using your extra phone number or your extra email, there is an extra process, but it's a very difficult process where you are asked questions about your account. Things like, when did you start it? Did you ever receive an email from this? Yeah, yeah. So that's a different kind of question. Now I understand what you're talking about. So they do, that is Google. Google does do that if you go to the recovery process. But what you, so you're going to gmail.com and you're saying, let me actually look at what it says. I'm going to log out of my Google account. Mm-hmm. It says, is there a, like, forget your password?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, forgot password ? And I'm going to look at that site. Enter the last password you remember, and you did that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And just doing that once, and it says you've done it too often.
Yeah, then when I put in, you know, I click forgot password, and then it'll ask for more options.
Yeah, the first thing it does is it says, well, use your last password. And you entered the one that used to work for you.
Yeah.
Boy, you've got me on this one, and the chat rooms too, trying to figure out why would Google say you've logged in too many times. If somebody changed your password, they know your new password, unless they, I guess it could be. I don't know what's going on here.
It's just crazy.
Yeah. And yeah, it's funny that you went to Google. I've never heard of anybody actually banging on the door there. That's interesting. Yeah. There is a phone number you can call if you find the Google support number, and there's chat as well. If you go to help, there's a contact number. I would try that. I don't understand,
because I've called Google up, and you know, I get somebody and they say, you know,
they're not
very
helpful.
Provide email support.
Yeah.
And then they said, well, we'll try and help you. And then they go, well, you're not giving the right information. And I don't know what other information it could be.
Yeah, well, that's because the bad guy has changed all of that information. And now it sounds like you do have to go to the process. If none of those backup systems work, you do have to go through that process where they ask you questions that, in theory, only you would know when you created your account and all that. The problem is, no, I don't remember that. No one knows all that stuff. Do any of your other Google services work? Is it just your email, or is it everything?
It's just that email. My other email works fine.
And
recovery email.
Boy, you got me. I'm really not sure what's going on. And this is part of the problem with Google in general, is you can't count on support from Google because, well, it's a free service, and the support is mediocre at best. Let me keep thinking about it. See if I can get help from the chat room. Maybe they have an idea. Quite the mystery. I just don't know. Our show today brought to you by Carmenite, the data protection leader. Gosh, if you've been listening to our shows, you know Carbonite is a longtime sponsor. From customer data to disaster recovery and backup, they are the guys to protect your stuff. And they are so smart. They have patents and all the technologies they use. Really, there are so much more than just your backup solution. I want to call them your data protection platform for businesses, including backup disaster recovery. You know, in business, they have different needs than end users. If you lose a hard drive at home, it's okay if, you know, later in the day you get your data back or tomorrow. In a business, every minute of downtime is money lost. So they have what's called high availability backup that gets you back online in case of disaster in seconds. No revenue loss. They have a workload migration technology, which lets you move from server to server within your company or keep you from getting locked into any individual cloud provider. Their newest solution, they're really proud of, and I agree, it's pretty cool, Carbonite Endpoint Backup. For businesses with mobile devices, businesses with multiple locations, you need a solution of hybrid backup and archiving that safeguards your data wherever those user endpoints are. And you want to do it without overpaying for data that's duplicated, for instance, or overtaxing network resources. Carbonite Endpoint Backup is the only endpoint backup solution featuring true global deduplication of encrypted data. They actually have the patent on it. So whether two users have the same file or 200, happens all the time in a company, but Carbonite's algorithms will make sure it's only uploaded to the vault once. That saves you space, it saves you time, it saves you bandwidth, it saves you, ultimately, it saves you money. It uses strong AES 256-bit encryption at rest. Each data set has its own encryption key. This is really cool. That helps protect all of your data from cyber attacks. And since each key is just for a little snippet of your file, even if somebody stole the key, that would only unlock that little snippet. And by the way, that's the secret to the global deduplication, right? Because normally you can't dedupe encrypted data. You can't see into it. But with the snippets, you could say, oh, that's, yep. You can dedupe. That's why they have the patent on that. 2 million endpoints in a single vault, as many vaults as your company needs. So it scales from, you know, when you're in the, just a startup to all the way up to the Fortune 100. No problem. Plus, with this kind of flexibility, you can deploy in the public cloud. You can deploy in a private cloud. You can do it on-prem. I would suggest you combine all three. They have a proprietary tool called QuickCache, which backs up small data sets locally throughout the day over LAN. Restore speeds, by the way, when you do it that way, are 10 times faster. Backup is faster, and there's little bandwidth disruption because it's basically backed up to the cloud overnight when nobody's using it. Carbonite Endpoint Backup also enables remote wipe, even more security and peace of mind, not just for laptops. Carbonite Endpoint Backup makes phone and tablet backup easy. Centralized management to set retention and access policies easily. You have the option to delay backup when using cellular data or battery power. Rapid access for end users to any file backed up across any of the endpoints. I can go on and on. What you should do right now, go to Carbonite.com. Carbonite.com and learn more about Carbonite Endpoint Backup. If your IT guys are saying, hey, we need endpoint backup, if you're looking at your system and saying, we're spending too much money on duplicating files, if you've got laptops, if you've got mobile devices, multiple locations, you need Carbonite Endpoint Backup. Find out more at Carbonite.com, the data protection platform. We are baffled by this, Melanie. I'm looking at the chat room. Sorry, I had to take a little break there, but I'm still here. Are you still there? Okay. I don't want to let you go until we figure this out. So you've tried it on three different devices.
Mm-hmm.
And each time you wait a while and you try again, you wait a couple of hours, you try again, and it still says you've tried too many times.
Correct.
You have in the past seen that, what's your recovery phone number or recovery email, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it has sent you a link or a number to the number or the text message?
Yeah, there was a link and then you went into that and you put the code in and everything.
And what happened then?
Then, it worked before and it's not working now. It just, kicks me out every time.
So it's no longer, the system's no longer working.
No.
But you are getting the text message, so the phone number hasn't been changed.
Yeah.
You
periodically I'll get the text message in, But most of the time it says you've had too many attempts, and then I can't put it in, and then occasionally I get it so that I can. And then it just says that you didn't answer the questions correctly.
Oh, okay. So you're getting the recovery options.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't know the right answers to when you created your account and all of that.
No, I do. I found when I created my account the exact date. I had it stored in my email because I also have Outlook. If I didn't have Outlook, I wouldn't be able to even see my password.
So you believe you're answering those questions correctly?
Yeah, I do.
You sure you're logging into the right account?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I've had several people try and help me that work for computer companies and stuff, and they're baffled.
It really sounds like you're not logging into the right account.
I swear I am.
Yeah. Well, I guess you must be, because it is sending you the thing that, mm-hmm. that is really important to this is that when you ask for the recovery email or the recovery text, you are getting them, right?
Yes.
That's key, because that means it is your account, and B, whoever changed your password did not change that information.
Correct.
But that apparently Google's not accepting that as a way to reset your password. It's still going to ask you those other questions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it sounds like you're stuck. I don't know what you could do about this at this point. If it says no, that's not. What are the other questions they ask? Like mail you've received. I've seen this before. Mail you've received from accounts and stuff, or.
Yeah, the main question they ask is, when did you start the account?
Right, but then there are a couple more. Do you think you're getting the answers right to all of them? You need to answer them all correctly.
That's the only one I really get. I don't get, like, what's your mother's maiden name? I don't get
No, they don't use secret questions like that. What they're trying to do is make sure that it's not somebody hacking your account but you. And so they'll ask you questions that in theory only the owner of the account would know, like when you created the account or have you ever received mm-hmm. an email or sent an email to this account or things like that.
Yeah, they don't ask that. The only thing they ask is the date that I opened it, and I know it's right because I have the email from opening it.
You've tried this on your phone, you tried it on different computers, and it's exactly mm-hmm. the same result on all of those.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So that tells me, even though the chat room is adamant that you have to clear your history, has nothing to do with any individual system, guys. You can stop shouting at me. User 4254, you're wrong. You may stop talking now. It's so funny, the chat room. Sometimes you get people in the chat room who are just sure they know the answer, but it doesn't make any sense.
Mm-mm.
It is, problematic if Google, has decided that those are not the answers.
And even I occasionally got in to, write out what was wrong and send it to Google, and they say they'll come back to you in 3 days.
Yeah, you just can't
come
get
back in 3 days.
Yeah,
3 days, and they say, "Oh, I'm sorry,
can't help you." Yeah,
yeah.
A free account very rarely. You're going to get decent support because they just, they're not making any money. They're making so little money off of you. So you know your email address, and that's correct. You enter your mm-hmm. password, and it says that's not the password. Mm-hmm. You then go to forgot my password, and you mm-hmm. say, here's my recovery phone number or my recovery email. It sends you a link. You click that link, and then it says, okay, you need to verify your identity.
It usually when I do that, then it goes in and it says you've had too many attempts. It never goes verify. I've never had verify your identity. It just goes, sorry, too many attempts.
Oh, you don't get the questions right away.
Mm-mm.
Now that hasn't happened lately.
No.
Now it just says you've tried too many times.
Mm-hmm. I even tweeted the CEO of
They're not going to help you.
He was not helpful at all.
They're not going to help you. Yeah, I can't think of, frankly, I don't think I can help you. I don't really know what you could do at this point. One thing to try, and it's not a bad idea, is to go use your Chrome browser on your computer and start an incognito session. Do you know what that is?
No. Uh-uh.
Let me see which menu. I think it's in the file menu. Yeah, new incognito window. And what it does is it opens a window without any credentials, without your information.
Okay.
Just to make sure that it doesn't have any, making any assumptions about who you are, and try that process.
Okay.
It's possible, Lawn Dog, you're right, that it's a bug in their systems, but that doesn't mean, that's not very helpful for poor, for poor Melanie. This is rare, but it does happen. And when it happens, there's not much recourse, frankly.
Mm.
So try doing it in incognito mode. Wait a day. I don't think the hacker's trying to do all this. Here's one possibility. Somebody changed your password and then forgot what they changed it to and is now trying to get in to your account. I guess that's, but they'd have to be, you'd have, I mean, you've waited and you've waited and you've waited. I mean, they'd have to be like constantly trying. So that seems like, it seems unlikely. Try this incognito mode. Just in case, you know, clear the cache, reset the browser, that kind of thing. But since you've tried it on multiple devices, it seems unlikely. Do you use Chrome on your desktop?
Yeah, I did, and then someone's telling me I should use Firefox.
Well, you could. You could download Firefox and try it. It wouldn't have any information about you at all. Mm-hmm. So it might be a clean way of trying it. That's about the only reason to do that. Since you've tried it on your iPhone, you've used Safari and Chrome. They don't communicate, so... I'm puzzled. The whole thing seems very strange, but at least try that incognito mode. Melanie, I have to run, unfortunately. And keep listening, because maybe somebody will come along with a good suggestion for you. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk about computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smartwatches, and getting locked out of your Google account. 888-ASK-LEO is my phone number, 888-827-5536, toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. The website, techguylabs.com. And you can go there for anything I talk about. We put it all up there. Questions and answers. Each page of the site is a show. Each show is divided into hours, each hour into segments. You can drill right down to the part you want. There's no charge for this. There's no sign up. You can read what I said. You can even watch audio and video of the show after the fact and leave comments. And I'd really like your help with Melanie. If you've been listening and you have any thoughts about what Melanie can do, our caller ending the hour last hour couldn't get into her Google account. I spent some time during the break with her, and I, frankly, I'm stymied. Don't know what's happening. This is a problem, and I don't want to scare you away from using Gmail. I like Gmail, but it is true that if something goes wrong with Gmail, unless you have, you know, one of those paid accounts, a G Suite account, you can't expect much support. Frankly, you're not going to get support from Facebook or Gmail or any of the free services you use, Twitter, because they don't make enough money on you to pay for a support call. You know, one call to a support technician costs them 20, 30, 40 bucks. I don't know, a lot. And at best, they make $4 or $5 a year on you in advertising. So while that's a lot of money for Google, you would quickly be costing them a lot of money if with support. I love it that Melanie actually went to the Google offices in Irvine and banged on the door. That probably scared the heck out of them. I do recommend, and let's prevent somebody from hacking your account if that's what happened to her. Let's prevent that by turning on two-factor authentication on any account, any login that offers it. And Google for sure does, Facebook does, Twitter does, Instagram does, pretty much everything nowadays allows you to turn on two-factor authentication. And what that means is you need two pieces of information to identify yourself. All of this comes down to, frankly, a fairly thorny problem on the internet. How do you prove that you are you? Authentication is another word for it. And it's an important problem for logging into your Google account. It's even a more important problem when you sign a check, use a credit card, transfer money. And in fact, we've been pretty lucky because the authentication process is much better, frankly, for Google than it is for signing a check, right? Or that's why there's check forgers or using a credit card. That's why there's so much credit card fraud. We need a better system. Two-factor is a step in the right direction. We're starting to use two-factor for credit cards. That's that whole chip and PIN thing. The chip in your credit card identifies you, and then if we don't use PINs in the U.S., we ought to, but our system is slow to adapt. We use chip and signature. Chip and PIN's better because then you would have the credit card. It's a physical thing you have, and the second factor would be the PIN number that you had in your head, and that would make it a much more secure system. Similarly, with Google, you'd know your password, but then it would text you a code or you use a program on your smartphone called an authenticator program to generate a code. Only you would know that code because only you would have, you own your smartphone. And that really stymies hackers. They don't like that because it's one thing for them to guess your password. And nowadays, if you're not using a password manager, you probably have a fairly guessable password. You know, a dictionary word plus your birthday, that's easy. That's trivial. So you want to have a good password. And if you have a good password and if that leaks out, you have a second factor. The bad guy has to get your phone. That means you're probably not going to get hacked. I use it on my bank. You really want to use it on your bank account, things like that. So get two-factor turned on all of these systems. Then you won't worry about hacking. And then really use a password manager so that you can have strong passwords and don't forget them. The password manager ensures that you don't forget them. You do have to remember one password. That is the password to unlock the vault. And that should be a very good one, not your birthday, not your dog's name. That should be a really good random password. That's the one password you'll memorize, and then the rest are stored in the vault safely. They're generated by the password manager, so they're good passwords, they're strong passwords. That would really solve it. I wish I could have helped Melanie. We tried everything. I don't know what's wrong, but use that as a cautionary tale to protect your own Google account. Turn on that recovery phone number. That's very important. Have a secondary email in your Google account, that's very important. And as long as you're doing that, turn on two-factor as well. It's a little less convenient, not a lot, but it sure protects you. Google has a good security check you can go through as well, google.com/security. Run through their security check and make sure you've secured everything. We're going to have to replace passwords. It's really not a good system at all. But nobody's coming up with a better way of authenticating. This is the problem. We need a good, strong way to authenticate. Prove that you are you. That's why Apple's trying this Face ID. You know, that's not a password. That's something, you know, your face. Samsung's using an iris scan. That's a really strong password. Fingerprint, very good. But you'd want to combine that with another factor, even then, in case somebody steals your fingerprint or points your phone at your face without your knowledge. 8888 Ask Leo. If you've got a suggestion, you can call us. You can go to the chat room, irc.twit.tv. Let's help Melanie. Let's figure it out. Let's solve this problem. Or you can always go to the website, techguylabs.com, and leave a comment. Lionel, is it Lionel in Los Angeles or Lionel? Hi, Lionel.
Leo, thank you for taking the call.
How do you say your name?
In Spanish, it's pronounced Lionel.
Lionel.
In English, yes. In English, Lionel.
I'll say Lionel. Hi, Lionel. Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call again, Leo.
What can I do for you?
I have a question regarding, I'm on the market, maybe eBay, trying to buy a used laptop, but some of them have Windows 10.
And you don't want Windows 10? What do you want?
No, I want to go back to Windows 7.
Yeah, I don't like used laptops because you're buying somebody else's problem. Sometimes you can get a good deal. You just have to be very, very careful. Truthfully, you can get a good deal on eBay. And I would imagine there are people selling Windows 7 laptops. Although, because Microsoft offered that free upgrade for so long, I think probably if I were thinking of selling a laptop, I'd just run the upgrade. But you should ask the seller because you may be able to roll it back to Windows 7. You can also, a better way to get a laptop is to get a refurbished laptop. You'll save some money, not as much as you would maybe with a used laptop. But if you get a refurbished laptop from the original manufacturer, very important, say Dell.
Okay.
If you get a Dell refurb, they stand by it with their full factory warranty, and you know it's in good shape. It doesn't have the same problems that buying something off of eBay would. And Dell may still sell. I would look at, if you search Google Dell factory outlet, see if they have still some Windows 7 laptops. I wouldn't be surprised if they do.
Okay, and then one more reason why I want to go a little bit back is because the newer laptops today don't have any optical drives.
You're going to have a hard time. Yeah. I think even the Dell factory outlet won't have any CD or DVD drives in there. Yeah, that's going to be harder and harder. You're going to have to just be very careful on eBay. It's really challenging on eBay because there are scammers there, and you can get ripped off. I hear from people all the time who have been ripped off on eBay. So be careful. But on the other hand, you can get some pretty darn good deals there. So. I mean, they're legitimate sellers on there, obviously. In fact, I would say most of them are legitimate, but there are a lot of scammers, and it just makes me very nervous. Where else can he go to get a used laptop, I wonder, that's safe? Maybe your local computer dealer, especially if they'll stand behind it. HP sells end-of-lease laptops with a warranty. That might be another way to do it. Nice to talk to you, Lionel. I hope you find a great laptop. Be careful. Newegg apparently sells refurbs too at a good price. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Oh, this Melanie thing is driving me crazy, the Google account. I'm going to keep working on this. We'll keep taking your calls too. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Now I've logged out of my Google account. One of the things I do, and this is for hardcore people, but I'm hardcore, is I don't use an authenticator app. I use a YubiKey. As my second factor. That's a physical hardware key that has to go in the USB port. Over here, I should take it off the keychain. So now to log back into my account, I have to use my YubiKey. Oh, something went wrong there. Try again, says Google. So there's my password, and then here's the key, and then it goes, oh, yeah, that's you. So nobody can hack my account unless they get this. Watch them mug me to get this. But then they'd have to torture me to get my password. And by the way, you wouldn't have to torture me for very long. I'd say, here you go. Whatever. Don't pull my teeth. No dentist drill.
Yeah, don't sign me up for any newsletters. That's all I ask.
Yeah, please. All right, putting that back in here. Yeah, I agree, Lawn Dog. She's not waiting long enough. It's a very strange issue. I don't know what the hell's going on with that. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888. Ask Leo, the phone number. Dan in New Jersey's on the line. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
Hey, come on over to the phone. Thanks for hanging on. I appreciate it. What can I do for you?
No problem. Leo, it's rainy here in New Jersey for a couple of days, and I finally found some time to do another chore, which once a year I try to do when I have nothing else to do, and that is to rip some DVDs and get them from their old DVDs onto my computer so that perhaps I can stream them.
Ah.
But it's such legacy hardware and software.
That's probably why Lionel wanted an optical drive in his laptop.
Exactly. I mean, there's still some people I deal with who want, files delivered on the...
You know, I bought... I use Macs, but Apple sells a USB, they call it a super drive, DVD drive.
Right.
There's a lot, you can always buy an external... Cheap, too. They're under $50 external drive. So you want to rip them. What can I do to help you do that?
Well, sometimes I have trouble with the software. I have a Mac. I use a VLC in combination with Handbrake.
Okay. So let me talk about ripping DVDs. There's two ways to do it. You're doing one way. One way is to preserve the DVD intact with all the VOB files and the index files. And that way you'd get the menu and the extras when you play it. And you could use VLC to play it that way. In fact, VLC has an open disk command. You can open a folder as if it were a disk. And it looks exactly like it's the DVD. Problem with that is it occupies a lot of space, like the same amount the DVD occupied, 4 to 9 gigabytes. Or you could do what you're doing, which is use Handbrake to just take the movie file, rip it from the DVD, and re-encode it so that it's smaller, usually about a gig for a two-hour movie, and then play it back. The problem, of course, is you have to put it in a format that Apple's or your whatever computer or device you're using to play it back understands. In the case of Apple TV, it has some very limited capabilities, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how are you getting it to the Apple TV? Are you airplaying it?
I am. Well, lately, again, I revisit this once every year, so I have to almost remember what I did.
Yeah, you do. You have to reinvent the wheel each year. Yeah,
exactly. But lately, I have been using like a media server. And
yeah, what most people do is they get a big drive, sometimes a network-attached storage device, terabytes, so you can put many movies on there. You put your movies on that, and then they run a server, a media server, like Plex. Are you using Plex?
That's it. That's what I'm using, Plex, on the Apple TV.
Perfect. So you use Plex, and the Plex server is running off of either a computer or, better, a network-attached storage device, which just appears as a shared hard drive on everything in the house. So you rip it at your computer, copy it over to the network-attached storage device. Those movie files are now visible as if it were a local folder on every device. And any device can run Plex, your phone, your Apple TV. And then the Plex client looks for a Plex server and says, ah, I see the Plex server. Is it seeing the Plex server?
Well, right now I'm running it. I just have it in a folder on my iMac.
Okay.
All the media.
So you need the Plex server for that. Plex on the Apple. It does see that.
It sees that.
But does it see it as a Plex server?
It sees it. I don't know. I think I click on the Plex app, and it opens up, and I see the picture, like the icon.
Okay.
The movies.
And what happens when you try to play it?
And then usually they work. The ones that work, work. The problem is a couple of things. Sometimes I get I just ripped one and it came out all distorted. I thought I did the same thing I always do, but it came out all boxy, sort of pixelated, the movie. And of course, it takes 3 hours to find out.
Yeah, because you have to churn through it with Handbrake. So.
Yeah, and then you see it comes out and then you go, oh. Now what do? Change one setting and try it again.
Let me ask the chat room, because they're going to be the experts on this. I actually don't do this. This is an old school system now. Everybody, physical media is gone. Everybody, whether it's for music or movies, and I predicted this years ago, but it's really happening now. They now just stream it. They either have, right?
A lot of these, though, my problem is when I hit a wall where they're not available.
Right.
Any place, like on YouTube.
Right.
You can't get them in any store.
My friend John just gave me The Magic Christian. I don't think that's anywhere. Great Peter Sellers movie from the 60s. So he gave it to me in the format. I can load it as a disc. So first of all, Handbrake should have, if you slide open the drawer on the right, an Apple TV profile.
Right.
And are you using that?
I used that.
Because that's all the settings. And what Handbrake is, just so you know, is a front end for a command line utility called FFmpeg that can do anything. It's like the most amazing power tool. And there are many, many settings. Handbrake even says, don't change these settings. You'll be nuts. But that's why it has some presets like Apple TV that should give you ideal settings for the Apple TV.
Right. So that's why I kind of did that, and I didn't understand, because I'd done it before, why it would come out all screwed up. And, of course, before I get to call you, I call, and then they say some 64 change your this to that to 32-bit to, whatever. And I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
Going too deep. It's deep.
This, you know what?
It'll be fun.
Somebody. So Beatmaster, does make MKV, does that you make something that Plex can, the server can read and render? MKV, the Matryoshka format is another very commonly used format for movies. It's actually a wrapper for movies that a lot of pirated movies, to be frank, are stored in. So I think it's probably a very good format and fairly compatible. It's a wrapper, kind of like QuickTime's a wrapper or AVI is a wrapper. And that doesn't tell you, that's something wrapped around an encoded file and doesn't tell you what the encoding is. Oh, Handbrake does MKV. All right. I would stick with, I don't know why if you use the Apple TV settings, you're getting the wrong, it sounds like the wrong aspect ratio. That's where it's stretched. That's aspect ratio. Or you're getting the bit rate messed up. I'm not sure exactly what's going on there. You might try looking for a Plex preset. See if that works better since you're using Plex to play it back. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So I'll tell you what we are going to do. Beatmaster's given me a... article. We'll put a link in the show notes for the media formats that Plex supports. It may be that encoding it for Apple TV isn't the best way to do it because you're using Plex to play it back, right?
Right.
So the Apple TV, if you encode it for the Apple TV, it's assuming that you're going to use Apple TV's sharing or AirPlay.
Right. Well, it's true, too. Well, I don't know.
That's something I would try if you encoded it at Apple TV, is try, instead of using Plex to play it back, you know, on your Apple TV icons, one of them is computers. And you can have that computer shared with your Apple TV, and you could try playing it that way or try AirPlaying it if it looks right in any of those situations.
And actually, well, the one I opened it up in on my TV, when I got screwed up, I just opened it up in QuickTime. You know, I just said, let me just see how it looks.
Yeah.
That's where it was screwed up.
Okay. So QuickTime may not understand what you've encoded. There are many ways to play it on the Apple TV.
Okay, yeah, yeah. So that was the, right, and it's, it's an M.
That's an MPEG file. That's the standard for Apple TV.
Oh, yeah.
But what's happening, it sounds like, is it's giving you the wrong frame rate and or the wrong aspect ratio. So it's stretching it or squeezing it. Or the information is not properly stored in the file for the Apple TV to render it properly.
Well, is 30 frames per second, that's fine?
Yeah.
And also, one more quickie. Do you have to, I know, because a lot of times they want you to have VLC also installed.
That's because VLC decrypts the copy protection. Doesn't work on Blu-rays, just works with DVDs.
But does it have to just be on the computer?
I think what happens is, Handbrake used to have the DCSS software that would decrypt it, but they didn't want to get in trouble with the Motion Picture Association. VLC apparently doesn't care. So if you can encode it, it's working. I think by putting VLC on there is sufficient, although Handbrake may say you need to open the movie in VLC. What happens is when VLC opens the movie, it puts the key for decryption in memory, and Handbrake knows where to look for that and can use it.
That's what I figured. It's kind of sneaky like that.
I think Handbrake should work. It's just a question of choosing the right settings for Handbrake.
Okay. And if anybody in the chat room, I know... knows who might be listening to this, at least to the podcast.
They have lots of solutions. If you go in the chat room, you'll see a ton of stuff.
I'll even pay.
Well, you shouldn't have to pay. I think Handbrake is good, but I think it's mainly getting the right settings.
All right. Well, thank you very much then, Leo.
All right. Take
care.
We'll see
what happens.
All right. Oh, even Blu-ray works with VLC. That's nice. I didn't know that. I thought Blu-ray was a little more challenging. If you're using VLC as a default Blu-ray player, you can follow the steps to give VLC Blu-ray the capacity of decryption. Just remember that the AACS Dynamic Library just could decrypt part of Blu-ray discs, so does VLC Blu-ray. I don't know what that... I no longer do any of this stuff. I watched The Darkest Hour, the Churchill movie that's nominated for Best Picture yesterday. With Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill. So good. Such a good movie. We're trying, as always, I try to see all the Academy Award nominated flicks before they come out. But I missed half of them. So I have some work to do. I have to see Phantom Thread. I have to see The Shape of Water. Everybody's raving about that. Do people in Germany care about the Oscars at all? Is that meaningless?
Of course they do.
Really? Oh, okay.
Of course they do. Well, I personally don't really, but...
Somebody does.
I know a lot of people. Yeah. I've grown up on Hollywood movies.
Right.
Tons of them, yeah.
Sure. So have I. So have we all. It's our common culture now. All right, here we go. Yeah, I didn't renew my membership in SAG-AFTRA in time, so I didn't get all the free movies yet. I have to... You have to pay your dues before September to get it. I forgot. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number. And at this time of the day, we always like to talk to our photo guy, Chris Marquardt. He's here from discoverthetopfloor.com. He's a professional photographer, teacher, podcaster, and an all-round great guy. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
Guten Abend. You are here to help us take better pictures. So help. Help!
Help. Help is on the way. Don't worry. I wanted to... Well, we talk about technology a lot, and with all the tech, it's kind of easy to lose sight of what's important.
It's art.
What makes a good photo?
It's art plus technology.
It's well, the camera has a role in getting the focus right, getting the exposure right, getting white balance right. So there's just a lot of like technical sides of the photography. But then you as a photographer have also a role. And it's, for example, in timing, like when do you press the shutter? It's where you point the camera. It's like how you compose the shot. And most importantly, what you include in the shot, and even more important, what you don't include in the shot.
Okay.
That's a very important decision. So what I want to do is just bring this whole thing back from all the technology that we talk about to the very beginning, to what is important in photography. And I want to talk about one thing. We talked about this years ago, but I think it's really helpful to bring this up every now and then as a little reminder. It is the subject. Do you know what a subject is in the photo?
The subject.
It's the main player.
What is this a picture of?
It's exactly. It's what the photo is about. Okay. And it is really easy to come up with a photo that you don't really know what is about, what it's about. So it's very helpful for you when you take your camera and you take the photo to decide what is important in the photo and then make the photo about that. And there are like, let's say, 2-3 ways to help make that a bit more clear. Because photos that have a clear subject, that where it's very, very obvious what the photo is about, are often the stronger photos. So you want to do a few things to make that photo more important, or make that thing that the photo is about more obvious. First, tidy up. I mean, tidying up is a good thing everywhere, but in a photo, what that means is you want to look through the viewfinder on the display, and then you want to look at what it's about, but also what is going on around it. There will be things around your subject that might not be helpful, that might be in the way, that might distract from the subject. So tidying it up doesn't necessarily mean go in there and take those things out physically, but it could mean that you walk around the subject, you explore the subject, you look at it from 2-3 different angles, check out what's going on in the background of the subject, what's going on around it, if I look at it more from the right, more from the left. That's an exercise that everyone can do. It takes a bit of time, but it will help you in the future see better what works with the subject and what doesn't. So walk around it and try to see how it works in the context of its background by changing that background, by walking around it. So tidying up means not necessarily going in there and taking things out, but taking things out visibly by walking around. That's the first thing. So get that subject a bit more space in the shot. Second thing, how can you make the subject be more important? How can you make the subject feel more like a subject? There are several ways to do that, to make a more important. Think of a person. You're taking a portrait of someone. That person is the subject. How do you strengthen the subject in the shot? Two really good ways. One is put that subject in a frame. And that could be a window frame. That could be a door frame. That could be even just something that is adjacent to that person, maybe a tree next to a tree, and the branches of the tree on the top, and all of a sudden you have a frame that comes in from two sides into your photo, and that gives the subject a good place to sit in the frame. So you have ways to support the subject. Framing is one way. Another way is to compose the shot in a way that lines point towards your subject. So that will help the subject. Well, let's say a railing or a window frame or anything in the shot that makes a line, you can move around until that points towards your subject. And that will strengthen your subject too. That will make your subject more important in the photo. And we're talking about the basics here. This is not dependent on the camera at all. You can do this with any sort of camera, a big DSLR, a smartphone, a mirrorless camera, any camera. Doesn't really matter. Even a pinhole camera, you can use these kind of things. So tidying up and giving the subject a good place in the photo to sit. That's kind of the two really important things that will help you make that subject more important and make that photo more clear and less cluttered. Tidying it up.
I think we forget, you know, a lot of times when we take pictures, it's really, I'm getting my family and friends, or, oh, it's a beautiful sunset. And you kind of forget that there's a subject, and that when you take a picture, the picture is intended to communicate to the person looking at the picture.
Exactly.
We think we're just... And maybe this is a legitimate reason to take a picture, just memorializing something that's happened. You know, I just want to remember this. And maybe that's enough.
But wouldn't it be so much nicer if that garbage can wasn't in the background, or if that tree didn't stick out of that person because you didn't look at the background? So if you moved a bit around, you might have a memory that is just a million times better without really putting a lot of effort into it.
I have a picture I took in Germany, of all places, your home. I was, in Germany, one of the competitions between cities is over their sausages, right?
Oh, yes.
It's a big deal.
Yes.
Yeah, everybody says our sausages are the best sausages. And I went to a town that claimed to have the best sausages and the best beer, and went to the place in the town on the waterfront that had, you know, that was famous, but been there for, I think, 300 or 400 years. Serving the same sausages and beer. Well, they made fresh every time. But I mean,
do you remember the name of the place?
Oh, I'll remember it. I took a picture of it. I'll find it. And it was a great picture. The beer was there. The name of the place is on the beer, I'm sure. If I tell you, you'll know. But I'm going to find it in my Google Photos. But I was paying attention to the food, the beer. I didn't notice that there was one of those portable potties, bathrooms in the background.
Plastic porta potty in the background.
It ruined the picture.
Yeah.
So I'm going to use
those and plastic bottles on tables. Also, often take a lot of the mood out.
Yes, the sausages looked so good until you notice the porta potty sitting behind them, and then it really, frankly, turns you.
And then you'll have to take a lot of time to clone that out somewhere.
Yeah. So, yeah. In fact, I'm going to try that program that you – by the way, I loved those programs you recommended last week, the great iPhone and some of them Android programs that you can use to make stickers and stuff. And that AI program – what was it called? Adhesive.
Wasn't that fun? Sticky's AI, I think.
Sticky's AI. I've been playing with that. Maybe I can use Sticky's AI to remove the porta potty from my sausages picture.
And
bring it back to life. Hey, we are taking pictures for our assignment every month. Chris gives us a new topic to focus on. What's our topic this week?
Topic is repeat, and we will review the pictures next Sunday.
Next Sunday. So you have one more week. Sunday. Take a picture illustrating the word or concept repeat. And you decide what that is. We're not going to tell you, but I'll tell you what you will want to do is tag it with the word repeat and upload it to Flickr.com and then submit it to our tech guy group. Make sure the tag repeats in there so we know it's a submission for this particular, I don't want to say competition because there's no reward. Well, there is a little reward. Next week, Chris is going to pick his three favorites and talk about them on the radio and give you a little credit. So repeat. You'll find Chris at discoverthetopfloor.com. Check out his workshops, his books, and more. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks, Liam.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I'm looking for my sausage photo here. It's a perfect example of what you're talking, because I just wasn't paying it. I was so enraptured by the beer and the sausage. It was in, you know, Nuremberg is famous for its sausages, right?
They say Nuremberg is also, they have also good beer.
Yeah, they say we have the best sausages, we have the best beer. Maybe if I search Google for sausage. Do you think Google's smart enough to know?
I think so, yeah.
Wouldn't that be funny if it did?
They do
it
a pretty good job. And
unbelievable. Sure. Look at that. So, Wurstkuchel. I was at Wurstkuchel.
Wurstkuchel.
Yeah, really good place. Now, that's actually an okay picture, but I have
that's
one.
That's okay.
Yeah. Somebody's butt is in the picture, but other than that. So it must be the next.
Well, the sausage is also made from someone's butt.
Yeah, somebody's butt. It's a pig's butt. So that's bad. That's as bad as having a porta potty in the background, frankly. But boy, those were good. Okay. So Wurstkuchel is where? I think if I look for that, I think that's the place.
That name. I guess that name is quite common.
Oh no! But this is the Wurstkuchel. It's the tavern, the old stone bridge. It's by the Danube, the old stone bridge, the 500-year-old historic Wurstkuchel. It's famous where the Middle Ages,
Regensburg
stone masons and dockers treated themselves. So it's a charcoal grill. I mean, it's 500 years old.
It's a beautiful, Regensburg is a beautiful city.
Oh,
very,
I love Regensburg.
Very photogenic, yeah. Very old.
Yeah. It was wonderful. A nice we had place. A great time there.
Definitely great beer. But then anywhere in Germany you go, you will find great beer.
I know. But that was sausage.
And everyone claims so to make good. The best beer, of course.
Oh, let me see if I can just search for Regensburg. Now that I know the town.
Easy.
I should be able to find all the pictures from Regensburg.
Well, is the porta potty at least out of focus? That's the question.
No, it's quite visible.
Or is it?
It's very frustrating.
Does it even say on it what it is?
I was there July 7th, 2015.
By the way, to effectively remove stuff, try Affinity Photo. They have
Affinity
Photo has a tool called Inpainting Brush, the Inpainting Brush.
Yeah.
And that is magical. That takes stuff
that's
off.
That's a good tip.
Very effectively.
That's a very good tip.
Sometimes better than Photoshop.
Let me see. July 7th, 2015. Beautiful Regensburg.
I think everyone in the chat room now wants to see that porta potty.
I know. I have to find it because I think people will think I'm lying, but I'm not. I didn't know if you'd know what a porta potty was. I guess you do.
Of course.
Yes.
They are as common here as they are everywhere.
You know, I don't have a porta potty in this one. It must have been another place.
Around construction sites and things. You see,
there was construction on the river. This was a good place to eat, though. Then have the Wurstkuchel.
A proper beer garden at the Danube River.
You know what? I bet this is a crop. I bet I cropped out the. But I forgot. I still got the butt in there.
Or maybe Google Images was smart enough to see that you did want that porta potty and then
cropped it out. Yeah, Regensburg was beautiful. Yeah, that was a fun trip we had. I just loved that. It's maybe one of our most favorite trips down the Rhine, the Main, and the Danube.
Awesome.
Thank you, sir.
All right. See you again in a week to review the repeat assignment.
Repeat. Gotta take some pictures.
Take care.
Thanks. Bye. Gotta take some pictures. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888. Ask Leo. That's the phone number. Let's go to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mark is on the line. Hello, Mark.
Hey, Leo. How you doing?
I'm great. How are you, sir?
Doing well. My son, Jarrett, is just got out of boot camp, and he is at the music school. He got his orders to go to Japan.
Wow, what a great post. Is he in the Navy band?
He's going to play in the 7th Fleet over there, saxophone.
Oh, that's so great.
And he's getting married before he goes over there.
Very nice. So it sounds like it's all happening at the same time.
They're all trying to get life going.
Yeah, you must be very proud of him. That's really exciting.
We are.
Yeah.
Well, the question is, he owes 400 some odd on his iPhone, and then he has it paid off, and they told me at Verizon to take out the SIM card and find something, have him find something over there.
Yeah, here's the good news. Yeah. He doesn't have to pay it off. Verizon was ordered by the FCC in a rare action against cell carriers because of misrepresentation, I think, of their bandwidth, of their unlimited bandwidth, to unlock the SIM card in all Verizon phones. So, the Verizon iPhone is probably the best iPhone to get because you can put any SIM in there. So, he doesn't have to pay it off, though. Verizon was correct, though. He can when he gets to Japan. How long is he going to be stationed there?
He'll be there about 4 years.
So he probably does want to start using it with a Japanese carrier, right? Because you don't want to pay Verizon for 4 years. That's not a good idea. So he will be continuing to pay his Verizon bill until he could. I think Verizon will let him put it on hold until he comes back. I'm sure they will. So he's going to find a Japanese carrier, and that Verizon phone, I believe, will work in Japan. There are issues sometimes because of the radio frequencies, but if it does work in Japan, and I think it will because they do support the CDMA frequencies as well as LTE. And he finds a Japanese carrier, puts that SIM in, he'll have a Japanese phone number. Remember, it will no longer have an American phone number.
Right.
But he'll be able to use them as his service. Now there is a site he can go to. It's really meant for travelers, but it will at least tell him a little bit about which carriers are available to him in Japan. It's called Prepaid with Data. It's designed for people going to visit Japan and do the same thing. But it works for 4 years as well as 4 days. Prepaid with Data Wiki. So just Google Prepaid with Data, and you should find it. It's got a long URL. I'd give it to you, or we could put a link in the show notes. But and then if he searches in Japan, it has a good listing of the different carriers, what they charge, things like
that. Okay.
And so that's
in the chat room.
Yeah. And well, yeah, somebody, Ken put the link in the chat room. Thank you, Ken.
Okay.
And then there's another link to how to suspend service at Verizon, which he'll want to do.
Okay.
Yeah. So he's actually in pretty good. He's got a good phone. Normally Verizon's not a great phone for traveling, but Japan is one of the few countries in the world that still supports the CDMA network. So he should be in good shape there. Just remember, he will know his phone number will change. He will no longer be getting calls at that old Verizon number.
Right.
He can set that up. Once he gets the new number, he could, if he wishes and might want to, set up forwarding on the Verizon number.
Oh, okay.
It won't be cheap. It'll be people calling him from the States, but at least people will be able to reach him.
Right.
Yeah, because his new number is going to be long.
The texting, I would imagine, would just work the same way?
Yeah, everything is exactly the same. But overseas texting, he's going to have to. This is where Prepaid with Data will be helpful. I bet you overseas texting costs money in Japan. I'm not sure, though. So he's going to want to check that.
Okay.
Yeah, now if that's an interesting question, if he wants to be able to get he might be able to have a carrier in Japan, as we have in the United States, that says, yeah, unlimited international texting, no problem.
Okay.
There are U.S. carriers, for instance, T-Mobile and Verizon. Google Fi. Both offer unlimited international texting, but that wouldn't be a good choice if you're going to be in Japan for 4 years. He also, don't forget, because he has an iPhone, he can continue to use Apple's messages with data. And if you have iPhones, you'll be able to get all those messages just fine.
Right, as well as Facebook.
And FaceTime, yeah. One thing and Facebook Messenger will work. One thing he might want to do is prearrange with all his friends and family, especially those not on Apple phones, to use something like WhatsApp or Facebook Messenger. Say, hey, we're going to use something that works on all phones, Android as well as iPhones. Facebook Messenger works everywhere, and he can make phone calls with Facebook Messenger, which means he'll use data only phone calls. That'll be free when he's on the base or wherever he's near free Wi-Fi.
Right, the Wi-Fi is the way we're going to communicate with him.
Yeah, Verizon has a military plan somebody pushing in the chat room is telling me. So you might want to check with the military plan as well, see what they have. The, obviously, a lot of people are in your son's shoes. They're going overseas for a few years. Yeah. That's good. Thank him for his service. And what a great way to serve our country, to play the saxophone in the 7th Fleet Band.
Yeah, we're excited.
He's going to be sick to death of Anchors Away by the time he comes back.
There you go.
But he'll have a lot of fun. You know, well, there was another great saxophonist. He served in the Air Force. You may remember Glenn Miller.
Right.
So there's a good tradition of that. Thank you for calling. I appreciate it. Have a great day, Mark.
Thank you.
Take care. Yeah, they do have, Verizon and other carriers have these international plans, but they're really expensive. You know, you get a day pass and that kind of thing. And if you're going to be there 4 years, that's prohibitive. Just get a Japanese SIM card with a Japanese carrier. If you go to that prepaid with data site, all the information you need. That's fun. Stan in Victorville, California is next. Hi, Stan. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo.
Hey, how are you?
How you doing?
I'm good, Stan. What's up?
I have a problem with my wife. Well, actually, it was with my computer, but I just got the fall update on my computer.
Yes, sir.
And the problem I was having is when I went to update my computer, on the update screen, I had an exclamation point next to the updates.
It says you can't do it?
Yeah, it wouldn't let me do any. It wouldn't update at all. But I just turned the computer on when I called you so I can tell you exactly what was going on. And I got the fall update.
It changed its mind.
Yeah, now the problem has disappeared. So,
well, you see, I can even fix problems through the phone. It's amazing. Microsoft a couple of weeks ago said everybody now should be getting the fall update. I've always said if it says no, there's a good reason. It's something that you have on your system that's maybe incompatible. But if it's going ahead and doing it, you definitely want to do it. Not only is it new features, it's got a lot of important bug fixes in it. And frankly, if you have a Windows 10 machine, you don't have the option to defer it. You can defer it for a year if you're home Windows 10 Pro. If you're Windows Home, you can't defer it at all. You're going to want it, and you have to take it. So might as well go for it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So is all installing fine and everything?
Yeah, it's updating fine now, but good. Now I have a question about my wife's computer.
Yes.
The same problem. It won't update. She's running Windows 8.1, but every time I go to update it, it will do the complete update, and then it'll give me the bar graph, and then we'll say 100% completed, but then it will disappear and give me a screen that says unable to install updates, uninstalling changes.
Something failed. And it's protecting you by rolling you back, which is something new. In the past, you might have been stuck with a non-working computer. So there is something going on that's blocking that update. Does she have security software on there?
I took off the Webroot.
Good.
I deleted it.
Good. You might want to go to Webroot. And by the way, Webroot's fine, but sometimes security software can block it. So you might want to go to the Webroot site and make sure. I think they have an additional uninstaller that gets any bits and pieces that are left there. I would make sure that all security software is uninstalled before you do the update. You definitely want that update because, you know, in this case, that's not the Fall Creators update. That's a separate update, but it's a security patch, and it's very important. Sometimes that happens, and if you Google Microsoft Update Troubleshooter, they have some helpful tips. What can happen is if an update fails, future updates will be blocked. That's not good. And they may have a way of finding out. I wish they told you why they wrote it failed, you know, but they don't.
No, they don't.
They don't give you any additional information. So I would try making sure Webroot's completely uninstalled, see if Webroot has an additional program, a standalone program to do. Most antiviruses do, because it's hard to fully uninstall an antivirus.
Okay.
And then if that fails, take a look at Microsoft will have a Windows 8.1 update troubleshooter, and they'll have some suggestions there.
Okay, I'll do that.
Sometimes that requires a registry edit to unblock an update, things like that.
Now I have one more question for
you. Sure.
I have a Sony receiver.
Yeah.
home theater receiver.
Yeah.
And I have a Xbox One, and I've been reluctant to plug in the Xbox One to the Sony receiver because I know it will take the PlayStation. I wonder, would I have a problem if I plug the Xbox into it?
You mean the HDMI cable from the Xbox?
Yeah.
Not
yeah.
at all. I have my Xbox plugged into an AV receiver. There's two ways the Xbox can be run. And I used to run it the other way, where it's a pass-through device. Microsoft would like you to use the Xbox to watch TV. I don't like to do that. I like to use the Xbox like you would a Sony or an older Xbox, where it's just a gaming machine on your system. So you'll notice on the back of your Xbox One, there's two HDMI ports. There's an in and an out. And that's so that you could take the Sony receiver output, put it into your Xbox, and then send your Xbox to the TV and use your Xbox to change channels. And I think that's dumb. So don't do that. Just use the HDMI out, plug it into the Sony receiver, won't be a problem at all. And then that HDMI port on your TV will be the port for the Xbox.
Right, okay. Okay, well, I'll go change that around.
Oh, believe me, this is the worst nightmare of all, right? Oh, honey, I got to go behind the TV and fix everything. Oh, it's the worst. Last time I did that, I labeled everything, tied up all the cables. I said, I'm not doing this again. But then you have to cut all the ties because, oh, no, I have to add something. I can cut all the cable ties and start over. Crazy. Oh, don't have cats if you don't want to do that. The cats keep knocking stuff offline. That drives me crazy.
All I use it for is to say Xbox turn on TV.
Yeah.
Xbox turn off TV.
Yeah, I do like that. They took that out. They don't have that anymore.
Well, mine still does it.
Well, you must have a Kinect, right?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. See, they don't sell that anymore. I do too, and I love that.
Yeah.
I'm lazy. Is that your wife?
Yeah. Trying to catch the dog.
Tell her hi for me, Stan.
I will.
All right. Hey, thanks for calling.
Okay. Thank you, Leo.
My pleasure. Take care.
Mm-hmm.
We're lazy. Xbox, turn on TV. I don't want to get up. Velcro strips, definitely the way to go. Don't use cable ties. You got to constantly cut them. I bought a whole roll of Velcro strips. This is working, by the way. My coffee's still hot. ESET has its own removal tool, but also other companies. That's interesting. Ah, and Windows 8.1 had that troubleshooter as well. I guess it did, huh? Yeah, I just discovered I can yell at my lights for my Google Home as well as my Echo. I do that. Windows Update Troubleshooter. Oh, that's good. All right. So at least in Windows 10, I think 8.1 might have this too. If you hit Windows key and type Troubleshoot, you can go to the Troubleshooter, and there is a Windows Update Troubleshooter now. I suspect that's the same one. That's great. That's a nice feature. Chris, it's not your coffee. Unfortunately, it is an Illy iPresso, or whatever they call it. It's good, though, with a little heavy cream. So I can't find the picture. You know, I probably deleted it with the porta potty in the background. I think I probably deleted it. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk tech, computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smartwatches, all that jazz. 888-ASK-LEO. That's my phone number if you want to converse. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada outside that area. You can use Skype Out or some other VoIP product and call, and should be free. 888-ASK-LEO. Our website, techguylabs.com. Very helpful for anybody who wants to, visit or write down something you heard on the show and you just, you don't have a pencil, a paper, you're driving. Don't worry. We do it all for you, and it's free. No sign up or anything. TechGuyLabs.com. We also appreciate your help there for some of our more intractable problems. Any comments you had there, very much appreciated. And those are free, too. You don't have to pay to help. Tech Guy Labs. You could join the team, Tech Guy. TechGuyLabs.com. One more help from our chat room on the Windows 8.1 that wouldn't finish its update, and it's so common. At least in Windows 10, I bet it's in 8.1 too. Microsoft has built the troubleshooter into the control panel. Yay, Microsoft. So if you're having trouble getting updates to run, you can press the Windows key, type troubleshoot, and it'll show up in your start menu. And it has troubleshooting for a number of things, including Windows Update. You can run that troubleshooter. How useful it'll be? Well, it just depends on what the problem is, you know. It can only do so much, I guess. Ted in Louisiana is next. Hi, Ted. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure.
I must say I enjoy all of your network's programs.
Aren't you kind? Thank you.
I listened to the podcast in my travels, and I must say your mom is one of my favorite co-hosts. You know?
My 85-year-old mother is the new star of our podcast. She's great, isn't she?
Yeah.
Because she's real.
Yes. I mean, it's where we're living. It's where we're day to day. You know.
Yeah, she keeps me. She keeps my feet on the ground.
She's great.
She puts me in my place. Thank you for. I'll pass along those kind words. Thank you. She's great. Yeah. Our podcast network. If you're listening and you say, what is he talking about? I do the radio show, but. Well, just working weekends wasn't enough. I felt like I should be working the rest of the week too. So we started a podcast network about 12 years ago called TWIT, which stands for This Week in Tech. And you can find it at twit.tv. So thank you for the plug. What can I do for you?
Well, I've got my daughter's old laptop that's got a CD DVD drive, so I want to kind of keep it going along.
All right.
And, you know, it was Vista, and that's long since not supported, but before it died, I couldn't update it. I could get to Service Pack 1, but I couldn't get to Service Pack 2. It kept giving me an error. So I partitioned it, and Windows Vista is on half, and then Ubuntu is on the other half.
Oh, aren't you clever?
Well, I don't know how clever I am.
Although that's a great thing to do with an older computer because, you know, Microsoft's really not keeping Vista up to date anymore. And way you keep an up-to-date operating system on it. It didn't cost you anything. Right. It's a little harder to use, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, and I went online through the Linux, the Ubuntu, I'm not saying that, portion, went to TurboTax to do my taxes, and it said that TurboTax is not fully recognized Linux.
Yeah, I don't think that should make any difference. Are you using Chrome as your browser or Chromium?
I think Firefox.
Yeah, that shouldn't make any difference. You might try, you can download, there's an open source version of Google Chrome that's designed for Linux. It's identical to the version Google offers called Chromium. In Ubuntu, it's easy. You just use your Ubuntu software installer and search for Chromium or Chrome, and you can install it. You might try that. TurboTax may still complain, but I don't think there's anything that – it's a standard web app. It should work just fine.
So when I'm going through that partition online and security-wise, how safe is all of that?
Well, you're secure for two reasons. One, because you're not using the mainstream operating system. So that means a hacker who's written a tool to take over Windows is going to be stymied by you. Doesn't mean necessarily there are not exploits, ways to take advantage of Linux. There are. It's just that people would have to know you're running Linux to take advantage of you, and most of the time they don't. And there are exploits against Chromium and Chrome and Firefox as well, but they get automatically updated, so if something is discovered, they're fixed right away. And both Google and Mozilla, who makes Firefox, are very good about keeping their system up to date. So I would say you probably are more secure in Linux. Linux isn't flawless. No software is. But it benefits through obscurity, and it benefits by being an open-source operating system that is updated pretty regularly by a lot of people. So you'll notice as you use your Ubuntu that almost every day the software manager will say, hey, you got some updates. And that's because people who make open source software, unless they abandon it, which happens also, but most of the time the software you're using is getting updated very regularly. So I would say it's probably preferable to using that, certainly preferable to using Vista, which is out of date and not being updated. So that's a real problem.
I'm just afraid to, do anything on that side.
Yeah, I don't blame you. So I know a lot of people, for security reasons, they say, yeah, I'm just going to use Linux for banking and high security stuff. There are hyper secure versions of Linux you could use. There's one called Tails, T-A-I-L-S, and there it's based. I think it's based on Ubuntu. And then there's another one called Cubes that is really weird and different, not based on Ubuntu. But I think you're fine. As long as you keep your Ubuntu up to date, it is very, it's very secure. And unlike Vista, the Ubuntu folks are keeping it secure.
Okay, great, good.
It's a good choice.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. I don't think you need to worry about TurboTax on Ubuntu. I think that that's just a cautionary warning. You won't find anything that doesn't work. It's a standard. Yeah. It's a standard web app. That's the that's the beauty, by the way, of web apps. It's kind of the future in some ways. Of technology, as we're moving more and more to the web. You've been using, many of you, a web app for more than a decade. Google's Gmail was the first widely used web app, by which I mean you're in a browser. It looks like you're browsing to a website, but that website is really a program. Same way Microsoft Word's a program. When you go to Gmail, you download a bunch of JavaScript code that's running on your computer. The only difference, really, is that you didn't install it. It's installed by going to the website. And Microsoft's already decided, Google as well, Apple a little slow on this, but the future of applications are these web apps. But they're calling them progressive web apps. Because, and particularly on mobile, instead of going in to the Play Store or to Microsoft App Store to install an application, you'll just go to a website. The website will be a progressive web app, which means it'll download to your device, your computer or your phone. Your phone will have something called service workers that can do some of the heavy lifting, and it'll even work if you're offline. So, I mean, that's an application, isn't it? You know, a website you have to be online to use, but once you've downloaded it, and you don't have to install anything, it just happens automatically, you can continue to use. And TurboTax, I am sure, in the next few years, I'm sure they'll make that a web app, a progressive web app. It's just a natural thing to do. That's a perfect example where you might want to continue to do your taxes even if you're not online. You're on an airplane or whatever, and you go to the website, and no way, it still loads even though I'm not online, and I can still add stuff and enter stuff and do my taxes. That's pretty cool. I think that's the future of applications. So, and if that's the case, then it should work with anything, including Linux, because all of these operating systems will have support for this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More calls still to come. Got some room on the board. 8888 Ask Leo. A couple of lines open. If you have a question, comment, suggestion, love to hear from you. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Very funky. That's Michael Cozio, our musical director at the keyboards, keeping the tunes rolling. Ryan in Billings, Montana. Hello, Ryan.
Hey, Leo. How are you doing
today? I'm great. How are you, sir?
Yeah, I think I have a solution. That lady that's having trouble logging into her Gmail account.
Love to hear it.
I didn't hear the first part of the call, so was she trying to log in on using her phone?
Phone, computer, laptop. She tried on four different devices.
Well, the only thing I could think of is if she's using her phone, she might, you know how the apps, when they can collect junk files and when they're running in the background?
Yeah.
Well, what I do often is I go into settings and then application manager and then look for that Google app and bring it up. And then you see where it says manage storage and clear cache.
Yeah.
The first thing she wants to do, I think, is clear the cache.
Okay.
And then click on Manage Storage.
Yeah.
And you'll see three different things. You'll see Clear Google Search Data, Clear File History, and Clear All Data.
Yeah, she was on an iPhone. You're on an Android phone?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, that would, if she cleared all the, it wouldn't, you know, delete her personal information. It wouldn't delete the app, but it would clear all the junk files. And it would maybe eliminate that.
It's certainly worth a try, and it's a harmless thing to do, that's for sure.
Right, and because, you know, when those apps are running in the background, it just collects a lot of, you know, when I go through and clear them all out, it'll release sometimes a whole gigabyte worth of free storage space.
Great tip. Thank you. I appreciate it, Ryan. Thanks for listening. Melanie's probably still listening, desperately trying to get into her Google account. Rick in Irvine, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Rick. Whoa, Rick, get to the phone. Come on, Rick. Rick, you're on the radio. Come on, Rick. Run, Rick. Run. Can Rick run? Is he fast? Come on, Rick.
I'm here, Leo. I'm here.
That was the funniest thing. I think I scared your wife.
Hi.
I picked up and she went, Rick. Hi, Rick. What can I do for you?
Well, here's the problem, Leo, with your vast knowledge. My wife at work, you know, uses her email both for personal and for work, but they don't care. All of a sudden, they decided to block Gmail and Yahoo and you name it.
Yeah. We had an employee for a while who was using her.
You know, I've tried all the obvious stuff. Anything with VPN on the website name that so that she could get a private VPN going, it's blocked. You can't reach it.
Well, and, does she like this job, Rick?
I'm sorry?
Does she like her job?
No, she doesn't.
Oh, now I understand. So she doesn't mind getting fired because if she tries to get around their internet policies, that's the risk she's running. And it sounds like they've locked it down very, very well.
Yeah, right. They have.
So
proxy servers are blocked. And
so here's what she has to do. She has to do what my 15-year-old does when we turn off the internet. Does she have a smartphone?
Well, yeah, but the problem is, yeah, she can use a smartphone to connect. But then, you know, you got the batteries. The new Samsung that she has doesn't allow a battery replacement even. And so you pretty soon are going to, if she keeps it on all day.
No. She might as well. That Samsung will last a long time. Keep it plugged in. Turn off Wi-Fi because, of course, if you're using the company's Wi-Fi, you'll be subject to their same policies. A company, by the way, you should know, has the absolute right to do this. And, in fact, worse news, the company has the absolute right to spy on everything you do while you're using their computers, whether you're at work or not. Now, there are rules to protect privacy on the phone. If you're on a company line and the boss wants to figure out if you're, you know, are you slacking and picks up the extension and listens into your call, the law requires in most states that if he hears personal information, he must hang up. He's not allowed to listen in. You're protected. But those laws were never extended to digital conversations. And the courts have time and time again upheld the opinion that if you're using a company computer or a company network or both, the company has the right to spy on you without telling you. So every time she uses that company computer, whatever she's doing, and it sounds like this company is very serious because if they're blocking VPNs, they know employees are going to try to get around stuff. They've got somebody in IT who really knows what he's doing, and it would be my guess a company like that is also looking at the activity going on their network, like spying on her. So don't try to get around this stuff. You'll be subject to getting fired. Or worse, they are spying on you, probably, in all likelihood. They are not required to let you know. It's my opinion that any good company, any company worth its salt, should have an internet use policy, which they publish, and they should tell all employees exactly what kind of surveillance they've got. But let's say you have a company laptop, the company-issued laptop. You take it home. The company is completely within their rights to put tracking software on that laptop that watches everything you do, even though you're at home on your network. It's their computer. And the courts will protect that right. So just assume you're getting spied on. The company has the right to say you can't do anything personal on your computer. You're in California, so it's a state where they can fire you at will anyway. They don't really need a reason to fire you. But if they wanted a reason, they could, you know, going around their internet policy would be certainly one that they would use. So maybe to deny you unemployment benefits, things like that. You'd be fired for cause in that case. So don't do it. Now, if she has a smartphone, she can turn off the Wi-Fi. She'll be using her hardware and her network. She'll be using her own, you know, network from the phone company. As long as they're not looking over her shoulder, she has break time. She could do personal stuff on break time. That's within her rights. So I would recommend that. Don't worry about using up the battery. That's crazy. People buy a smartphone and then don't use it because they're afraid they're going to wear it out. That's not why you bought the smartphone. It won't wear it out faster. Well, I mean, I guess it might, but it not appreciably faster. Keep it plugged in. What will wear it out a little faster is if you charge it up and then let it go down and up and down. You have a limited number of charge cycles on any lithium ion battery, including the one in your Samsung, typically about 500. So it discharges and recharges. You are wearing it out. But if you keep it plugged in, that isn't happening. Use it. You bought it. Use it. Don't buy a phone so you – this is the solution to her problem. Do not try to get around the company's surveillance. That's just – well, it's wrong. You know, if she hates the company, she should get another job. And if not, then she needs to follow the company's rules. I hate to say it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK-LEO, the phone number. John in Long Beach is next. Hi, John.
Hi, Leo. How you doing?
I'm great. Welcome.
I want to know about polarizing filters for point-and-shoot cameras.
Some point-and-shoot cameras have the screws on the front that allow you to add a filter. That's the easiest way to do it. If you do that, then you can get a polarizing filter. There's a variety of kinds. Generally, I'm told you want a circular polarizing filter. That'll give you the best results. If you don't have threads, though, on the lens of your point-and-shoot, then it's a little more tricky because you have to have some way to mount that on there. Do you have threads?
Yes,
have you looked? What kind of point-and-shoot?
No. And another thing, I looked into a magnetic holder.
Right.
But mine's not magnetic, and I'd have to glue on a magnetic
ring.
That's
how they do it.
Yeah, and then find the size ring for the polarizing thing.
Yeah, you got it.
So I thought maybe you had that answer.
Basically,
I might have to do it myself or design myself and take it to the guy and say, "This is what I can do." You know, I've got a CAD program.
Oh yeah, I guess you could 3D print something.
I think most
of the companies that make filters for point and shoot, and they will. That's exactly how they'll do it. They'll have a ring mount that you either that you attach to the camera. In other words, an adapter tube of some kind. There are cameras that have threads, but most of them, that's because it's a point and shoot. They figure, well, they're not going to do anything that fancy. Why do you want a filter on your camera?
Well, because when I go take pictures, I like to use the filter to bring out more color.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's nicer that way.
You bet.
There and stuff like that. And I can do that with my SLR, no problem.
Yeah. Oh, you already have an SLR. I see.
Yeah, I've got one. It's not digital. It's a film camera.
Yeah.
But I loved it when I was taking pictures years ago. But I got a new camera. I got one at the garage sale, and it's a nice one. But, I'm stuck. You know, I want more. But
this is how you get spoiled.
These lenses, they all close up flat. So
that's part of the problem, right?
The only the little rectangular opening, maybe something can fit in there to line it up.
Well, I would look for a system that comes with its own mount. That way, you'll be. And who makes the camera you're using?
I've got a Casio.
Okay,
it's a EX-H30.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm looking, there was a company called Carry Speed that used to make something called a mag filter that's gone. But I think there are other companies. You just have to get one that will fit, you know, a bracket.
That's nice, I can't use a 52 millimeter, you know?
No, yeah. Although, yeah, you might be right. You might be better off just designing your own mount for that Casio. It's the kind of point of shoot that a lot of amateurs use, not a lot of demand for filters. I'm guessing that nobody's making one for the Casio. If you had a Canon G5 or something like that, then, you know, which a lot of pros use, then there might be some demand for that.
Yeah, that's tons of money, you know.
Yeah, I know.
I don't want to get that deep. I can get a digital SLR if I want to go that way.
Well, I know you're. Yeah, exactly. I would say keep listening. Somebody will know. We have lots of photographers listening. He's got a point-and-shoot Casio. He wants to mount a filter, a polarizing filter on it. Is there a company that makes a magnetic sleeve or adapter tube that will allow you to do that? Somebody will know. And if you can't call in, 8888-ASK-LEO, only about 20 minutes left in the show, don't worry. The website's there for your delectation and contribution, techguylabs.com, techguylabs.com. Back to line two, Richard in West L.A. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Leo. Good to talk. I'm very interested in getting an SSD for my Asus maybe four-year-old laptop, but the local shop says I have to free a certain amount of space in that machine in order to install an SSD. Is that true?
Yeah, well, it depends on the laptop. Some laptops really don't have user accessible parts inside. What model is it? The Acer what?
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't remember the model.
Yeah. So I had an old Acer, for instance, S7, which I loved, but it was about 12 millimeters thick. There'd be no way you could put an SSD. Actually, it came with SSDs, but it came with dual SSDs that were rated together, oddly enough. It was a strange configuration. But they were probably surface-mounted chips. There wouldn't be room for you to go out and buy a 2.5-inch laptop drive and stick it in there. It's just too thin a laptop. So this will depend very much on the laptop. I would suggest a couple of sites. There's one called iFixit where they take apart stuff. If they've taken that one apart, they'll have videos on how to take it apart and how to upgrade it. You might also, so that's a good start, ifixit.com, ifixit.com. They're a sponsor of some of our podcasts, I should mention. So that's, but I love them. They call themselves the repair manual for the internet world. Who else would help? Companies that sell add-ons for laptops often have information and video. It really depends. What you probably should do is just Google that model number, Acer and laptop upgrade, and see if anybody's put up a video on YouTube or whatever, and watch the video. Because you want to see, first of all, if it's possible, and then if it is, how hard it is to see if you are willing to do it. A lot of laptops, I just put a new hard drive, an SSD, and my 2015 MacBook Pro, a 15-inch MacBook Pro, I'd only got a 256-gig hard drive in there. It was a small hard drive. I wanted more storage, so I ordered, went to Otherworld Computing at maxsales.com, one of my favorite places. Not a sponsor, by the way. I wish they were. I could could use some of that MacSales money. I've given them a lot of my own. But you go there, and they have the tools. They have the, you know, you could actually look up that model. And it turns out, if you have the right kind of screwdriver, because Apple doesn't use standard screws, you remove about 8 or 9 screws on the back of the bottom of the laptop. You can just take the whole thing off, and you have access to it. And it's very easy to put a new hard drive in there. But that may not be the case with all laptops. It isn't, in fact. Some laptops, it's easy. Some thinner laptops, particularly an Acer, makes some very thin ones. You couldn't. So it's completely dependent on the model. So find out what the model is capable of. You know, I'll Google laptop or a hard drive replacement for that particular model. You should be able to find it. Don, Los Angeles, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Don.
Hi. I just got a used touch. I forget what they call it. It's a touch screen HP.
Yeah.
And it has Windows 10 on it. And I bought it at a charity auction. And the very nice people that donated it left it password protected. So it came with, I guess it's humorous.
It depends where the password is. So if the password is in the Windows login, no problem.
Excuse me. I'm not trying to get the password. What I'm trying to do is
use it.
It came with Windows 7 on it, and I'm trying to reinstall factory reset Windows 10, because that's what's on it right now. I thought I could push a F11 or something.
So let me ask you again. Where does it ask for the password?
At login.
So you see Windows coming up, but it's asking for Windows password. That's easy to fix. All you have to do is download the Windows 10 installation tool from Microsoft. Get it from Microsoft, nowhere else. It's called the Media Creators Tool. Download it. Boot to the USB drive and just flatten the drive and install Windows 10 on it, and you're good to go. If it had been a hard drive lock, that would have been another matter. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So that's why. Oh, are you still there? No, he's gone. That's why I ask where the login is. If it's a BIOS password, or it's a hard drive lock, that's a lot more difficult and tricky. But if it's just the Windows password, wipe the drive and reinstall Windows, which I would recommend, even if you could get into it. You don't want to buy somebody else's problems, right? So download from Microsoft the media creation tool for Windows 10 and install on top of it. If Windows 10 had been on it and was activated, which it sounds like it was, you won't have any problem. You don't need their serial number or anything. It's already approved for Windows 10. You're done. Probably they knew it. I would think the people who donated it probably knew that and said, that would be good. Yeah, isn't it? So, Ant, do you know of I'm seeing adapters for point and shoots. The manufacturer might actually have one. I'm thinking Casio probably doesn't, but check the manufacturer, right? LensMate might have one. LensMate Online. Thank you, Denmos. LensMate Online. They make, that's cool. So they make a lot, little accessories, including quick change filter adapter kits for point and shoots. Now, that's for a Canon. See, my suspicion is that Casio is going to be a little harder. Yeah, they don't have anything for Casio. These are all for kind of semi-pro cameras. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 88-88. Ask Leo. A few more minutes in the show if you've got a question or an answer. You can also go to the website, techguylabs.com, and leave your thoughts there. No need to shout at the radio. We've made it easy for you. No fee, no charge to shout at me online. Mike in St. Louis, Missouri. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Leo. So I love the Amazon Echo, call it Echo. And I think yesterday you were talking about putting it in the vehicle using the Anker Row Vivo.
Yeah, it's a very interesting product. $50 device that goes in your serial port. I like Anker, A-N-K-E-R, as a company. And the Rove Viva goes in your cigarette lighter, adds two USB ports, so it's a charging device, but it also adds Amazon's Echo to your car.
I love the thought. My question is, when you're connecting it to Bluetooth, are you connecting it to where you need to change to your Bluetooth input to hear it, or does it connect?
It connects to your phone. So here's how it works, which is a little weird. So let's say you already have your phone paired to your car's speakers, right? You can play music through your phone. You can take calls on your car, things like that, right? Well, the way the ROAV works is it pairs using the ROAV software, by the way, requires this on your phone. It pairs to your phone. And then the software communicates with Echo on the cigarette lighter adapter. If you ask for music, It then plays it using their app on the phone into your car. Does that make sense? So you don't have to de-pair anything. It just requires pairing the Viva to your phone.
That all makes sense. So when you actually talk to it, you have to switch your car to your Bluetooth input?
No. Because you're talking to the cigarette lighter adapter. It has a microphone on it, and a little blue light lights up. So you don't have to. Go ahead.
So the response is, so when you're using an iPhone and you're going with the like a mapping software, when it speaks, it kind of simulates a phone call and breaks into your existing whatever input you're on, but. I have another one of these type of devices where I actually have to switch to the Bluetooth input in order to hear the responses from it. So I was wondering specifically if the Anker has to have the Bluetooth input selected, or if it will like simulate a phone call and break into my existing, so I don't have to switch over to that input every time I want to use it.
No switching necessary because the microphone is in the cigarette lighter adapter. It's paired to your phone as a Bluetooth. Not device, a Bluetooth speaker. So you, not speaker, microphone. So you talking to your phone. The software in the anchor is receiving that information, processing it, and then if there is any audio required, plays it from your phone to your car. So your anchor, the anchor is not paired to your car. It's only paired to your phone. The phone is paired to both the anchor and your car. No switching required.
Okay. Well, I will order one.
Yeah. Well, before you do, do look on their site because it doesn't work with all cars.
Oh.
So they have a list of cars they've tested it with that it works with. It's only $50. If it doesn't work, it's not the end of the world. It's a good gift. Right?
Sounds good.
Yeah, ROAV. I think they're out of stock. This is kind of a, I think in a way. Now, there's another product I'm told that's similar. I haven't tried, called the Muse, M-U-S-E, that may be in stock. But I don't know how that one works. So I have the Anchor Rove, R-O-A-V, Viva, V-I-V-A, installed on, I bought it the minute it came out, and I got it a couple of weeks ago on my Tesla. And it works exactly that way. It's a microphone, basically puts a microphone in your cigarette lighter and two chargers. So that's nice. And then you talk to it. It communicates with the app on your phone. You have to install the ROAV app on your Android or iPhone. And then somehow the ROAV app then tells the phone what to do, play or whatever. It works in, you know, it doesn't, it's not perfect. But it is the best way to put an Amazon Echo in your car. In future, you may not have to worry about that. Ford's going to have Amazon's Echo in some of its sync-enabled cars and others. So you're going to see more of those. I think it's going to be the last call of the day. I hate to say it, but Eric in Riverside, you win the prize for holding on the longest. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Leo. Hey, you got a question. I've got an old Windows program, Chessmaster.
Oh, I used to. Yeah, Chessmaster 2000. Love that.
Yeah, but I have a Mac now. So what program can I use to play that old game on my Mac?
Is it a Windows game?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there you can. Here's what you could try. There's two ways to do this. There's something called Wine, W-I-N-E, which stands for Wine is not an emulator. Wine works with some but not all Windows programs by acting as if it's Windows and intercepting the calls that Windows would be getting to draw a window, to do a menu, that kind of thing, and tricking the program into thinking it's running on Windows. So it works with some but not all. If you go to the Wine website, which I think is winehq.com, and it'll tell you which apps it'll work with. You know, it's okay. Sometimes a really old app like that is easy because it's dumb, but sometimes not, you know, so it may or may not work. The other way you could do it is in emulation. True emulation using a virtual machine. And there are a number of companies, VMware Fusion, Parallels. There's even a free VM virtual machine solution that works, that we're just fine probably for Chessmaster 2000, which is called, it's from Sun. I can't remember the name. It's now Oracle. I'll get the name for you in a second. But what you would do is you install that software, and then you have to install Windows into a window. So it's as if you've got Windows running under the Mac and then install VirtualBox. Thank you. VirtualBox. And then you install Chessmaster 2000 on that version of Windows. And when you want to run Chessmaster 2000, it's in effect running a version of Windows underneath the Mac. So Oracle VirtualBox is free. It'd be the easiest way to try it. And see if it'll work. Software Toolworks, 1986. Wow. There's a version of Wine from the Code Weavers, which is a commercial version called Crossover Mac, that might also be something to look at. But that one's not free. So Wine is free. WineHQ.com. Crossover from CodeWeavers.com. I think that's not free. There's two virtual machine systems that are commercial, Parallels and VMware Fusion, but probably the easiest would be get VirtualBox. You need to get a copy of Windows, though, and probably in this case Windows 3 or 3.1, right? If you can find it. Hey, thanks for joining me, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Have a great geek week. It's 1986. To be honest, there's better chess programs for the Macintosh, much better than Chessmaster 2000. I should have mentioned this. First thing I would do if you want to play chess on the Mac is join chess.com. And you can play in the website. They also have Android and iOS apps. And you play against real people. They also have machine games. Chess.com is a great – if you like chess, which I do, I'm fairly serious about it. I haven't played in a while, but chess.com is well worth the membership. And then there are commercial programs that are quite good, much better than Chessmaster 2000, which really wasn't that good. Remember, since 1986, computers have beaten the world champion chess players. So this chess.com has a computer game that you can play. You can play the computer that's better than Chessmaster 2000. But if you want to get even better than that, there's Fritz. There's Stockfish. Stockfish is free. And these are very competent. In fact, they're used a lot by professionals who are training, grandmasters and so forth, who are training to become, to play for tournaments and stuff. They often use computer software now, which is pretty cool. I think Stockfish is available for the Mac. It is for the iOS and Android. It's open source. Yeah, StockfishChess.org. You can get it in the App Store. It is very good. It's open source. It's free. And it's used as much for analysis as playing. It's a very – I mean, this is super powerful. Fritz was the world champion. Fritz is not cheap, but it has a lot of additional features. I hate this Safari does this. Ugh. This is really a problem with Safari. I got to figure out a way around this. Normally in Chrome, if you just put a space in there, it'll Google it, right? Safari tries to open it as a website half the time. This is made by Chessbase, which is the big... you can play Fritz online. Look at that. That's free. Huh. Fritz is very good. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy Show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, Security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.